is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian bunker, it's Micah Hanks. This is the Grahamian Report. Welcome to the program, my friends, and a very happy Valentine's Day to all you lovebirds out there. I'm joined in studio by a couple of lovely engineering staff. Across from me, the man with the plan, the producer extraordinaire, Mr. Chris Hayes. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Well, thank you, but I just really want to know, who's Harbo?
Who is Harbo?
Who's Harbo?
And the guy pushing all the right buttons over here to my right, you know, he's looking behind him. I'm talking about you, Mr. Matt Oakley, our engineer extraordinaire. Matt, how are you?
I'm fine. Chris, get off my board.
That's right. Leave his board alone. He's
you know
boring.
How much I like pushing buttons.
He's bored enough already there by himself. Let him be bored. Let him be himself. No, there's nothing boring about this program. Wait, ladies and gentlemen, you found your way to our dark little corner of the web, and however dark it may be, we are your light in the darkness. It's the Grahamian Report. Welcome to another week of weirdness, insight from beyond the fringes of insanity, and insight, my friends, and you are about to become host to a new kind of awakening, a new kind of enlightenment, the kind only we here at the Grahamian Report, live from Grahamian International Studios, hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, here in our little bunker beneath the Earth's surface, only we can give it to you. And boy, we got some stuff to give you here for this special Valentine's Day edition of the program. I must say, I'm incredibly excited tonight, not just because it's Valentine's Day. The paradames, the wonderful ladies in the lives of all the Grahamian Report staff are so angry. Well, on-air staff, at very least. They're very upset. We let everybody else take the night off. Everybody's going out and they're having dinner and they're, you know, they're getting the thing on, you know, for Valentine's Day, giving flowers and candy and all this stuff. And here we are stuck in the studio working because we are so dedicated to bringing you beyond the fringes, as we like to say here on the program. And
who's
I noticed
stuck. I just want to know who's stuck.
Who's stuck?
Because I absolutely would prefer to be here than
shh, don't let.
I mean,
they might be listening.
I'm sorry, honey. I'll be home at 11.
Well, I mean, like, the thing is I just don't think it means the same when we have interns deliver the flowers and candy and all
yeah,
that
Yeah, exactly.
Jazz.
You got to do some, you know, things in person, right?
Yeah.
The best part about that, though, is something. When you give them the wrong flowers, they get slapped. And
yeah,
don't.
That's true. And like, no, that wasn't me. I didn't give them that crap.
stupid intern.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Here's how it goes. Here around Grahamian Report studios, we're in here, and, you know, the paradigms are coming down the hallway and everything, and the interns run up, and the girls look at them, and they're like,
I never even saw these assholes before.
And I was like, well, honey, I mean, we were busy. You understand, don't you, darling? So anyway, you know who's really mad is Holly right now. Holly with an IE, by the way. She wants to make sure that everyone knows it's not Holly with a Y, Holly with an IE. You got to make those distinctions about people's names. People get upset about things. She wants to make sure everyone knows who she is and who she works for. Anyway, okay. All that said, I want to point something out. Since we're talking about Valentine's Day, I think that there's a nefarious conspiracy behind Valentine's Day. I really do. Think about this. Everybody thinks, well, first of all, let me paraphrase this by saying, in the next few weeks, we're going to have a wonderful roster of guests. We just received a review copy of Dr. Kirby Surprise's book. Yes, that's his name, Dr. Kirby Surprise. He's got a new book out called Synchronicity, The Art of Coincidence, Choice, and Unlocking Your Mind. You remember that scene from Total Recall? Open your mind.
You remember that scene from Scanners where the guy opens his mind too much?
And
oh,
it
yeah.
Explodes?
Yeah, it gets a little out of hand for him, doesn't it? But no, we've got him on the roster, and also coming up, we're going to have Dr. Ben Goertzel, you know, who's probably the preeminent expert on artificial intelligence in the world. He's going to be joining us next week, if all goes according to plan. He's in Tokyo right now, and I think we've got everything arranged for him to be able to join us for the interview. And then we're going to be joined by an incredible researcher who, you know, I first learned about him through the International UFO Congress. He was a speaker there, and he's got a lot of books out. He's got a new book out that we've actually got on the way to us, Saucers, Swastikas. What's it called? It's got a catchy title, and obviously I'm not good enough to remember it. But anyway, Joseph P. Farrell is the researcher. He's going to be joining us on the program as well. What? Our producer's losing it over here.
I just realized if you take International UFO Congress and make it even more, you know, abbreviated. It's IFOC. IUFOC. IUFOC.
Watch your language, sir. Anyway. Anyway, point is, Joseph B. Farrell, thank you for... Hey, would you put a lid on it? I'm talking here, okay? So, anyway, Joseph Farrell, would you kill his microphone, Matt? We want to make sure there are no further interruptions from our producer, who obviously is probably under the influence of some sort of... Well, no, you know what it is? And here's what I was getting around to begin with. Joseph Farrell, when he comes on the program, he's going to be talking not only about UFOs and where they may come from, but if there is indeed a Nazi connection and if there could be a cabal in our midst that is controlling international monetary flow and these sorts of things. Now, if that's the case, and we are willing to accept the rather bold hypothesis that there could be secret dealings going on in our midst that control finances internationally, military organizations and operations, all this sort of stuff, then I'm thinking, hey, bring it on down right here on the Grayling Report. Put it on the table. What about Valentine's Day? Now, think about this.
Are the Nazis behind Valentine's Day?
Possibly. Possibly. But what I'm thinking actually is more likely is this. What we're probably dealing with, you know, everybody wants to think that, you know, people are spending lots and lots of money on roses. People are spending lots and lots of money on candy. But really, who's raking in all the dollars on Valentine's Day? Who is it, Chris?
The restaurant industry.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's why we're going to see a sharp decline in listenership on this week's program, because nobody's going to be at home listening to the Grayling Report unless you've got like Sea Crane radios with Wi-Fi internet that you can listen on. Hey, that needs to be our new sponsor. Put that away in the back of your heads. But anyway, no, everybody wants to be out, you know, with their loved ones at, you know, their favorite dining establishment tonight. And that's just it. See, Valentine's Day, the whole hoax that is Valentine's Day is just a ploy to be able to put more money in the pockets of the restaurant industry. I think I've figured it out. You see, you got to really get up pretty early in the morning to figure this sort of stuff out. But I don't really exist in the mornings, but I still manage to figure this stuff out pretty well, wouldn't you say? Guys?
Yeah, you're doing all right.
Okay. Don't encourage him, Matt.
Okay, well, it was worth a shot. But you know what, Chris, I think it's probably safe to say that maybe Valentine's Day isn't everything people think it is. Now, I know that you were hesitant to get into this tonight. And all joking aside, no. We love our restaurants and, you know, we eat locally and all this stuff, you know. That's a big aspect of the local economy here where we broadcast from in Asheville, North Carolina, you know. Think globally, act and buy locally. And we advocate that, you know, and we love going to the local restaurants and everything. And I've got a lot of friends who are local restaurateurs, in fact. You know, people who took the leap and got into entrepreneurship, and they offer fantastic cuisine. I tell you, Asheville is in addition to being, you know, one of the top beer cities in the United States, I have to say it's probably one of the very best if you're a foodie, okay? And I certainly am. I love cuisine and cultural, you know, angles and aspects that can be associated with food and dining from around the world. Cuisine from around the world, I mean. So that's something I'm really into. But all joking aside, there are aspects of today, this holiday, Valentine's Day, that many people tend to overlook. Chris, now you've done a little research into this. There are a lot of things. First of all, tell us about St. Valentine, because I think that St. Valentine himself there is there's some misconception associated with this gentleman and who he was, or was there a gentleman by that name?
Well, yes, and actually there were 14 gentlemen by that name.
14, okay.
According to everyone's most amazing font of knowledge, Wikipedia.
Oh, this guy really is a researcher, see?
St. Valentine is the name of several, 14 in all, martyred saints of ancient Rome. Excuse me. The name Valentinus, derived from valens, or worthy, strong, and powerful, was popular in late antiquity. So there were a lot of Valentines and Valentines and, you know, Vinnies and things like that.
Did you say Vinny?
No.
Cousin Vinny was St. Valentine.
Joe Pesci. Cupid.
But the awesome thing I found out about Valentine's Day, not so much St. Valentine, is that it looks like it was first mentioned in Geoffrey Chaucer's book that I just lost the title of. Parliament of Fools.
Parliament of Fools, yes.
And it's set in the fictional context of an old tradition, and you know, it had no tradition of being a holiday before Geoffrey Chaucer wrote about it.
Although he referenced
and said
it,
that it was, you know, a holiday that everyone had bit. He basically created a fake holiday and a fake centuries-long tradition to go with it, and it just turned into that.
So I was right after all. Valentine's Day is a hoax, and it all goes back to Geoffrey Chaucer. Folks, you heard it here first. But now, there were some other legends that were associated right with, like, for instance, some of the traditions associated with Valentine's Day. For instance, one we discussed prior to the show was the tradition of giving Valentine's Day cards to your loved ones.
Yes, that's right. the tradition of giving Valentines is from when Saint Valentine was in, you know, prison awaiting execution. He would pass notes
Which Saint Valentine?
One of them.
One of them. Okay, so one of them was in prison. Anyway, go ahead.
If you want...
He was in the big house, folks.
You know, I thought we were in the big house.
No,
the old house.
This is the old house.
The old house. Okay, if you want to get nitpicky, it's St. Valentine the... Come on.
The 12th.
Yeah. The prepster is what I said earlier.
The prepster. He was a hipster. The first hipster, actually.
The presbyter.
Oh, the
presbyter.
Prezoba what?
Prezoba?
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 Who's Prezoba?
Who's this Harbo guy?
Who's Harbo? Anyway, when St. Valentine was in prison awaiting execution, he would pass notes to his followers through the bars of the window in his cell. And that's where it's commonly believed the tradition of exchanging Valentines came from.
And no doubt he was telling people how much he loved them, right?
Yeah, it was like, be mine, I'm about to be beheaded.
Be mine or beheaded. This could go on night.
That one wasn't that great.
Matt, did you give anybody a Valentine's Day card this week?
No.
I wonder sometimes if when people download the podcast, this is the section of the program that they're fast-forwarding through to get to the weird stuff. I thought was pretty weird, though. I thought this was the weird content. You know, I mean, I think that's kind of weird. Looking into folklore and history and tradition, you know, digging into the very essences of the strange and unusual in a way that allows us to understand what we are seeing, okay, and what we are experiencing in the world around us in a slightly different way. I think that maybe there are some people who just want the, you know, the gut-wrenching, you know, gory details about Mothman or Bigfoot or something like that. I've always been the kind of person who wants to try and appeal to a subtler approach. That's why I was interested in getting Dr. Kirby's surprise on the program. You know, this book right here about synchronicity. Synchronicity is one kind of phenomenon that has always fascinated me. It's not something that's overt. It's not as obvious as a UFO flying through the sky at supersonic speed. It's not as obvious as a Sasquatch, you know, jumping through the woods or something like that. It's not as obvious as a great big lake monster splashing around. But I think that the hidden essences of our daily existence that kind of suggest that there is more going on behind the scenes. Those are the things that really attract me. And I think it's a different kind of intellect that is drawn to that. I'm just so thankful that sort of intellect happens to be the very listenership of this program. The people who are drawn to this kind of program, whether or not it's Valentine's Day, they're always showing us love here on the Graylian Report. And we're glad to throw it right back to you. Cosmic love, all you babies. You're wonderful, and we love every one of you. Well, that said, we are going to get to some really weird stuff, and talking about the hidden experience of life. In the second hour of tonight's broadcast, we're going to be joined by Mike Cleland of the Hidden Experience blog, discussing owls and synchronicity. But after this break, there'll be more on Valentine's Day weirdness. This is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the Inception Radio Network.com. We'll see you there.
Fortians, Killians, and those from Lower Hadalopolis. And, of course, all of you out there online on the web listening to the program each week from 8 to 11 on Tuesdays. Welcome back to the program. It is the Graylian Report. Quick shout-out to a few folks out there. We've got a new listener, Teresa from Raleigh. Welcome to the program. Glad you found us. Hope you enjoy listening. It's a special Valentine's Day edition of the Graylian Report. We're always glad to have all kinds of folks interacting with us. And, of course, if you want to interact with us, there are a couple of quick ways to do it. You can send us an email, info@graylianreport.com, or shoot us a text message anytime, 828-367-7201. We'll have the phone lines open later in the program also. But continuing our discussion of this special holiday for lovers, it is Valentine's Day. And there's, you know, it's not my favorite holiday. Anybody here want to guess? You probably know what my favorite holiday is. Anybody know? What's Micah Hanks' favorite holiday? Look, here's a hint.
Arbor Day.
Here's St. Swithin's Day.
Here's a hint. Okay, my favorite color, grayly and green.
Thanksgiving.
Arbor Day.
Close.
Flag Day.
Closer. Hot, but no cigar.
Columbus Day.
The potato is almost burning my hand, but still not quite there.
Hadal Insurrection Day.
No, it's St. Valentine's. No, wait, that's today, isn't it?
Caught in a trap.
See, we tripped you up there.
You tricked me. No. My favorite holiday is actually St. Patty's Day.
Oh, hey, you want to hear a joke about Irish people?
St. Patty's Day. I don't know if I'm going to allow the producer to talk on this program anymore at all.
But the thing is, both of us are Irish.
It's okay. I can... You know what? I can say it. I'm Irish.
Yeah, okay, right? You're Irish, I guess. I don't know, Chris. Hey. I'm already sweating at the thought of you even talking, but if you think that you can do this and
I'm pretty sure I can do
okay,
it.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, Micah, what's an Irish seven-course dinner?
I don't know. Haggis, bangers and mash, cabbage, what?
A six-pack and a potato.
Baby, right? That's the Hadal joke. Anyway,
no.
Six-pack and a potato... Oh, never mind. Okay.
I protect my young with the fierceness of a mother lion.
You got it. Well, since we're talking about this special Valentine's Day edition of the program, now, you know, Chris and I typically, we kick off Tuesdays by running out and at some point, you know, having either brunch or lunch or something like that before we get involved in some show prepping. And, you know, there's probably nothing more romantic on Valentine's Day or between lovers in general than poetry. At least in my opinion. I'm a big fan of poems. In fact, you know, I've got a copy right here next to me of Ezra Pound's New Selected Poems and Translations. Because I'm telling you, I love poetry. These guys, they're snickering at me here because I'm talking about poems. But before you snicker and laugh too much more, guys, I just want to say again, I think, and now follow my logic here. What interests me so much about... What is your problem?
I don't know. Matt's over here holding his mouth. He looks like he's about to vomit, but he's like holding in a laugh, and it's making me laugh. I have no idea what he's doing.
It's too sweet. It's too sweet. I know.
What are you doing, man?
No, I don't want to know.
No.
I don't want to know. I was talking. Can you guys put a lid on
show.
It? Okay, go ahead, Matt.
No, it's okay.
Okay, thank you.
I was looking up paranormal Valentine's Day stuff, and, uh-huh. and the first thing that popped up on my Google search was... Alien butt sex for Valentine's Day.
Matt, turn your own microphone off. Thank you. All right, now, what we're going to talk about, you can turn it back on. I'm just kidding. Really.
Sorry.
Now, if I can continue uninterrupted, Ezra Pound, he was one of the first poets that I ever really listened or read, rather, and I began to think that there are, as you know, elements of you know, symbolism and even I think what I would call archetypes and the esoteric that are hidden away within the writing of a poet like Ezra Pound. Okay. Now I'll just be honest. I was a guy who growing up, I never really got poetry. You know, poems were something that you wrote for, you know, somebody that you liked in school or, you know, some waitress in a restaurant that you'd like to ask out or something like that, you know, and you write it in lipstick on the...
on the bathroom mirror.
I don't even have lipstick.
Right. Well, what's really terrible is if you're borrowing your girlfriend's lipstick to write the poem for the waitress on the napkin. Okay, anyway... So that's what got me into Ezra Pound, looking into, and not just him, other, you know, poets, because often the beautiful thing about poetry is that it won't come right out and say, there's always, you know, usually, I think in a good poem, kind of a hidden underlying theme or you know, idea that is being expressed, and the verses will convey half the story, and then you have to kind of read between the lines, so to speak, or between the verses, to be able to get the hidden essence of it. Now, we're going to feature a couple of poems here in a few moments, but again, I want to say that the reason for examining poetry is not just because poetry, I think, goes so wonderfully with Valentine's Day, and it can be kind of a sweet thing, but I think that it is kind of like, I remember an Episcopal priest once told me in describing sacraments, he said they provide a physical handle on a spiritual reality. Well, when we're trying to understand the unexplained and the esoteric and the hidden experience that we'll be talking about during the next hour with Mike Cleland.
Don't you mean speculating?
Yes, yes, we're speculating, but no, but when we're discussing these hidden experiences, I think that poetry, music, art in general, and thinking abstractly, these are all ways that we can try and connect with that unseen realm. So anyone who doesn't understand, I did, as a matter of fact, there was an article I put up on the Grayling Report a while back that was talking about Fortean themes in classic art. These weren't paintings that showed Bigfoot or saucers or anything like that. They were paintings that, you know, would show, I think one of my favorites was, Oh, What's That in the Hollow? And it shows a man lying there. It implies that it's a dead body and he's got dog roses or dog thorns, you know, growing up over him, and there are ravens landing next to him. They hint at something kind of macabre, something that's a little deeper. It ended up being one of the most popular single articles that appeared on GraylingReport.com in the entire year of 2011. And that, again, shows me that I think people out there, they get it, you know? And we all, in various ways, whether it be through synchronistic happenings, like we'll be discussing with Dr. Kirby Surprise here in the next few weeks, whether it's through, you know, strange dreams that they have. How often could I tell you the times that people call me up or email me and say, you wouldn't believe this strange dream I had. And it had very little to do, seemingly, with what goes on in my day-to-day life, but my God, the experience, what I was experiencing in the dream was so real. You know, there had to have been something to it. And that's why guys like, you know, Freud and Jung and all the classical psychologists, you know, they were really looking at dreams and symbolism, archetypes, as Jung called them, and all these things that seem to kind of connect us with the unseen realm around us. I think that poetry, much like that priest once told me, provides sort of a physical handle, you know, kind of an artistic expression that connects us with a spiritual reality that exists, but that we can't just reach out and grab. And therefore, for this special Valentine's Day edition of the Grayling Report, we're going to share a few poems. And Chris, I would like to start, my friend, with you. We were doing show prep today, and you literally wrote this silly little poem, and it was a joke, but I loved it. It was a poem to the gal, she's probably listening right now, who was waiting on us at the restaurant today. I'm going to embarrass you and put you on the spot. I want you to read your poem for us. Would you do it?
Well, of course. I don't really have any shame.
Okay. Chris Hayes, ladies and gentlemen, your poem. Does it have a title, by the way?
Yes. It's an ode to the waitress at Over Easy.
Oh, okay. Over Easy, of course, is the name of this restaurant. Okay.
It's the official breakfast spot of the Grayling Report.
Okay. There you go.
Should I use my poetry reading voice?
You should use your Chris Hayes, producer of the Grayling Report voice. Chris, why don't you read the poem?
All right. Do it news from the front style.
No, don't do that. God help us, don't do that. Okay.
It's only two couplets.
Two couplets.
Black of hair with purple tights, I think of you on Monday nights. I see you tues to break my fast. Our love, like omelets, cannot last.
I love it, though. He read that. We were just kidding around. He just put that together while we were doing show prep today. I was like, it's perfect. You're reading it on the show tonight. I love that. It's hilarious. Now, I've got one because when you know, I'm not going to put Chris on the spot without, you know, following up. Now, mine is a serious poem. Actually, it's not entirely.
Who said mine wasn't serious?
Okay, touche. Mine isn't entirely serious either, but it's more classical. Now, what we'll do is we'll follow this up with some classic poems, at least, you know, sections from those. This poem I wrote last year, it's called The Lover's Request. You know, a lot of people don't know this about me because I don't publish my poetry all over the place like I do, you know, my articles on the strange and unusual. But I love writing poetry. Who was it? Was it William Carlos Williams that called poetry the supreme fiction? I'm not sure, but anyway, I agree with that statement. Poetry as the supreme fiction. This is a poem I wrote last year. It's called The Lover's Request. I thought it would be very fitting for Valentine's Day. So, without further ado, the morning songs of sparrows bring me, awake to find the hour early, a thought that lost itself to sleep, and a heart and mind not filled with worry. Magnificent, a time since past, with humor, love, and parody, that lost ideal I see in your eyes, today thought such a rarity. 'Tis envy which my heart recedes from, longing for that morning song, afternoon or evening ending, early again your words bring dawn. What is this, some longing memory? Is this untilled earth we sow, or seeds of love she scattered wisely, whose heart touched mine so long ago? Her soul is older than the hollows, mighty as the winds that blow, the wisp of frost in verses stinging, cold and icy winter's bow. I wrap the cloak of Cordovan round our shoulders, cross her breast, thinking heat to bring this place, to warm her, while we face unrest. Damn these winds, they whip and drag me, though struggling, our pace is kept, and we, to enter warmth and heat, arrive again at her doorstep. By the fire's light, we're now together, warmer from the fire within us, though every other word she hears sounds as though he drowned in Guinness. So I ask my lady best I can offer, with what little left that she'll afford, to endure my drunken lover's ramblings, and keep me fondly of her own accord. For no lost or roving troubadour who ever sought to build his lover made one so sweet in all her facets. I think for my part, I'll have no other. And that's my poem. So I thought that that would be fitting for Valentine's Day. Now that said, when we get into like serious Valentine, you know, quality poetry, you know, Matt, you had a beautiful one there earlier that you shared as well, which is really, really good. And, you know, again, whatever I might consider myself to be as a poet, there's nothing that compares to this sort of thing.
Yeah, and this is a poem called She Walks in Beauty by the, you know, one of the greatest of all time, Lord Byron. And it goes as such. She walks in beauty like the night, of cloudless climes and starry skies, and all that's best of dark and bright meet in her aspect and in her eyes. Thus mellowed to that tender light which heaven to gaudy day denies, one shade the more, one ray the less, had half impaired the nameless grace, which waves in every raven tress, or softly lightens o'er her face, where thoughts serenely sweet express how pure, how dear, their dwelling place. And on that cheek, and o'er that brow, so soft, so calm, yet so eloquent, the smiles that win, the tints that glow, but tell of days in goodness spent, a mind at peace with all below, a heart whose love is innocent.
Isn't that good? That's fantastic. Oh,
remember that one, guys.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure I have a little tear in my eye. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, no, really. I mean, you know, for a special thing, again, I'm sure there are some people whose eyes are rolling out there. Oh, my God, they're reading poetry on the Graylin Report. But, no, truly. Again, the purpose of that, again, and the allusion I want to draw to, you know, between poetry or any expression of art and then the unseen around us is that, again, it kind of gives us a handle on things that we can't, you know, that we can't connect with. You know, I did an article for Mysterious Universe a while back that was called Sacred Duality, that was talking about yin and yang and the interaction between men and women and, you know, archetypes, you know, in our subconsciousness. And again, literally the elements that exist between individuals and interactions in our daily life, especially between the sexes, and how that seems to connect with this kind of deeper element of the unseen and the unexplained. And when we think about, I mean, you know, Chris, like what you were talking about earlier with regard to Valentine's Day and there being legends associated with it that really aren't entirely historical. That's usually how it is with almost any holiday. Holidays are a representation of a collection of different, you know, folkloric and archetypal kind of, you know, elements that all come together and constitute a celebration or a ceremony that is entirely, almost entirely symbolic in nature. You know, we celebrate symbolism that most of us, you know, we accept it so fully into our lives, whether it be Easter, Christmas, Thanksgiving, St. Paddy's Day, or Valentine's Day. You know, we accept these things and we celebrate them. We give gifts. You know, we go through these kind of ritual activities and we don't, most of us, even stop to think about what we're doing. It's so a part of our lives, these rituals that we engage in. And most people fail to even consider what the deeper meaning of the ritual and the repetition and the activity and the act and the symbolism, all of these things, what they actually mean. When we celebrate holidays, it's literally us fulfilling symbolic elements of this unseen around us. And those symbols, again, are like little channels to other aspects of our existence and our being, you know, that most of us don't understand in different ways. And I think that that's, or maybe not, I wouldn't say that people don't understand them at all. I think what it is that people, again, we have the capacity to understand about if we think about it, but we often don't. We get so caught up in the you know, go of everyday life that we literally overlook the hidden meaning, the hidden experience, which again I think makes it so fitting that we're going to be talking with our good friend Mike Cleland during hour two tonight. Now, Mike, is, of course, he is really multifaceted in his research and his expertise. I think really he, to my mind, is one of the truest classifications of a Fortean, or what I like to call a Keelian, you know, someone who really looks at different, you know, strange things that happen, but on a subtle level, not just someone who's just going for the full-on gore, you know, Bigfoot killed Loch Ness Monster, you know, UFOs blasted them both and took them to Planet X and all this stuff where they fought Godzilla. And I mean, so many people are like into the just like what you'd call the hardcore Fortiana out there, you know. I'm a hardcore Fort addict, okay? No, I'm not, but I think a lot of people are, and they overlook the more subtle aspects of all this stuff. Mike's one of those guys that kind of reads between the lines, and that's, you know, why his blog is perfectly titled The Hidden Experience. So we'll be talking with him about that during hour two. Let's see here. What else have we got on the table here? Oh, I wanted to bring up one more thing, too. During our discussion here about love and Valentine's Day, we've gotten completely mushy. We've shared a few poems. We've discussed the history of the holiday and these sorts of things also. And then there was one more thing that came to mind while Chris and I were putting together our show prep tonight. There was a book I remember. It's a fiction novel. Actually, it's a collection of stories that I came across years ago. I believe it was by Gordon Dixon, and it's called Love Not Human. It will always remain, along with Spider Robinson's Callahan's Cross Time Saloon, one of my very favorite collection of sci-fi and fiction short stories. And the reason why is because the paperback edition of Love Not Human that I received, I think it came in a large collection of books that were mostly about UFOs and things and channeling and different kinds of esoteric subjects, contactees and things that I inherited from a woman who passed away. And she left her book collection to her family, and they knew I was into this stuff, and they passed this book collection along to me. And it, along with this book collection of strange, you know, phenomenology and Fortiana and the like, there was also this book, Love Not Human, within a larger collection of sci-fi books that she had owned as well. Love Not Human had on the cover of the book, I love this, and it's such an enigmatic image. There is Nessie, the Loch Ness Monster, and she's got a scuba diver, and he's obviously unconscious, and she's got him in her mouth, and she's like swimming along carrying him. And in the story, I think it's the last in the collection, the story is that there's a group of hunters who are out there looking for the Loch Ness Monster. They're cryptozoologists. And they're hunting Nessie on the loch, and it's the winter, and it's snowing and everything. And meanwhile, while they're looking for Nessie, there is a family, a very small family of these age-old, you know, plesiosaur-like, you know, creatures, the, you know, the creatures, the Loch Ness monsters. I think that there's a mother, and there's an older male figure, and then there's a younger girl figure. There may have been another one. It's a small family, and then there's a group, a bunch of eggs too, and they're trying to hatch these eggs because they're, you know, lower in numbers. And over time, these creatures, having evolved under the loch for so long, they've like developed intelligence on par with humans almost. And so they're under the loch and everything, and they know about these humans up above that are trying to find them and everything. And the young girl is, you know, warned, you don't want to go near them, and you're absolutely forbidden to ever touch one of the monkeys. You can't do that. You know, you can't have physical contact with them, or it'll break, you know, the age-old taboo. Well, during one of these adventures, there's a scuba diver who's underwater and everything, and of course, you know, keeping in mind that under Loch Ness, you know, the peat moss that's actually present, this is true, the peat moss present in Loch Ness makes it so thick and murky, the water, that you can't literally see more than maybe a foot, maybe 2 feet in front of your face. So there, this guy's swimming under the loch, and the large male comes up, and he gets just close enough to where he can almost see what's going on. And then he gets close, he comes in, and then he whips his tail real quick, and he severs the line that's connecting the scuba diver to the ship and everything, which I guess is, you know, his breathing apparatus. And so this guy's knocked unconscious, and he's drifting along. And he says, come on, let's go. And the little one says, okay, sure, that's fine. But she sneaks back, and she gets him and takes him and carries him. But she's careful. She gets him by the, by his diving suit, and so she doesn't make physical contact with him, and carries him to this cave and kind of keeps him there. It's her little pet. And now this cave is partially underwater, and then there's air inside the cave. There's like a, you know, a portion that comes up out of the water. And so she has him there. She comes back to her family, and she's hanging out with her family. And it's such a beautiful story because, again, I think we've all been in that situation where, you know, you're a teenager, and maybe you've just started talking to someone, you know, in school. I remember it was like this, and I wasn't necessarily running around dating girls that my parents didn't know about or anything like that, but there is that sense of, when you first start talking to somebody, you know, this chick starts talking to you in math class, you know, or, you know, something like that. And there's that sense of it's something so new and something so mysterious. You can sense that is what's going through the, you know, these emotions are felt from this young Loch Ness monster. She's got this person back in this cave and she knows she's not supposed to. It's almost like Romeo and Juliet, but she, nonetheless, she has loyalty to her family. And she's doing these shifts of you know, warming the eggs that they're sitting so that they don't lose the little baby Nessies there. And at one point, she's literally warming the eggs and doing her shift. And then when her mom comes back after going and hunting for food and she comes and takes over the shift, then she'll be like, okay, I'm going to go hunt for food. But instead of hunting for food, she goes back to check on the little man. And she realizes that the man's in there and he's not entirely conscious, but he's freezing to death. And so she goes, she says, I've got to do something. And the process by which they could keep the eggs warm is that they could focus their, like, the Loch Ness monsters had this ability to, like, focus, I think, the warmth in their bodies through the flow of blood down into their bellies so that they could emanate heat from their stomach. So she goes up, and she says, well, I'll just hover over him, and I'll keep him warm. And he starts to warm up and everything because he was just shivering, and she was afraid this little thing's going to die. And so she gets up over him, so she's careful not to touch him, and she warms him, and he starts warming up, and he reaches, turns over, and he touches her, and she's like, and she realizes the taboo has just been broken. A human just touched her skin, and she's like, my God, what to do? But she says, well, there's nothing I can do now. I might as well just make sure he's okay. And so she lowers herself even closer and is touching him full on and making sure that he stays warm and survives through the night. So she doesn't get any sleep. She doesn't get any food. She goes all the way back. She does her next shift, you know, on, you know, warming the eggs and all this stuff. And it's so funny because she's keeping this secret from the other Loch Ness monster. She's got the enemy in their home and she's caring for him. Well, she goes back and he wakes up and he, at first he's fully aware of what's going on this time around when she comes back. He sees her. He's terrified of her. He realizes, my God, this is the Loch Ness monster. But he realizes after a few moments she doesn't mean him any harm. And they begin to communicate. And then he basically communicates to her using sign language how, when you take me back up, here's how I'm going to signal to you and I want you to come out. And it's a trap. You see, he's set it all up to where, well, you know, he's going to prove that there's a Loch Ness monster, prove it to the world. And so long story short, he takes her back and then he's returned to his boat and it's snowing. And there's this enigmatic scene where he's just up there and he's just staring out into the loch. And she comes up close and she really thinks this is my friend. And she's trying to come close and she sees this long, graceful neck of this plesiosaur come up out of the loch and it's coming up to him. And then he just starts screaming and making noise. And they end up trying to fire this gun at her and everything. And all of a sudden she realizes not only had they tried to hurt her, but he repented at the last moment and screamed and tried to get her to go, which she didn't understand, but he did it because he wanted to save her. And so it really, for me, encapsulated this entire series of stories in this book, Love Not Human, because the whole theme in the book is, you know, instances of love and camaraderie between species, whether it be humans and monsters or humans and aliens, you know. And I think it was just such a beautiful story. I really enjoyed it. So that's Love Not Human. You can probably find it on Amazon, I'm sure, and it's just a fantastic story. And, of course, that one was cool for me because it dealt with one of my favorite cryptozoological monstrosities of all time, the Loch Ness Monster. I think that about wraps up our Valentine segment of tonight's program. When we come back, we'll have some strange news. There have been more of those weird, loud crashing noises being heard throughout parts of the United States. We'll touch on that when we come back right after this on the Grailian Report.
Are you facing foreclosure? Then come down to Megalow and Partners. We're a mortgage rescue company, and we can help you keep your house. Provided you submit to our plans for galactic domination. No, no, I'm kidding.
If you're facing foreclosure, talk to the right people. Speak with HUD-approved housing counselors free of charge at 888-995-HOPE. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Graylian Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Graylian Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. It's the final segment of the first hour of tonight's Graylian Report. I was glad to provide you the best in weird news and analysis of the strange and unusual from all the four corners of the globe. And speaking of, I think in Latin America there's some sort of a different kind of celebration. They're not loving on each other tonight. No, it's something a little stranger there tonight, isn't it?
Yeah. Down in New Mexico.
So just regular America.
Yeah, I was going to say. But anyway, if anybody out there is not really keen on Valentine's Day, apparently in New Mexico, if you want to stop by there in the next couple hours, it is Extraterrestrial Culture Day.
I'm sorry, I guess I misheard you. I thought it was a different country.
New Mexico.
Then again, I mean, this is the home of Roswell, so maybe it is a different country.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're getting at. Apparently, it says the site of the most famous possible alien visitation in America goes all out for this offbeat holiday. So, still, you don't need officially authorized government approval of a holiday in order to go all out yourself in celebration, right? While couples around you are sporting roses and dining on truffles and champagne, you can wear an alien mask and eat octopus.
Wait. You can wear an alien mask and eat octopus?
Yeah.
You have to have an occasion to eat octopus?
Yeah. It says, octopus is entirely terrestrial. But you just know that the most extraterrestrial cultures probably dine on something resembling our strange underwater ally as the height of their local cuisine.
Oh, I thought you could just pretend you had ripped the face off of Cthulhu and were eating it.
That's right. We don't eat baby Cthulhus, you know. Anyway, yeah, that's right. That's the Cthulhu handshake. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to describe how you do this. Okay, first you take your left hand. Okay,
this is like a dance.
Yeah, it's like
class.
A dance. It's easy to do, and it's called the creep. Okay. Everybody, it's easy. Okay, this is easy to do. How to do the Cthulhu? Okay, at your house. Okay, all you got to do take one hand. Okay, now put it, hold it up in front of you. Let's all do this together
in the
studio.
Wrist.
Like your hands flopping around right in front of you. Okay,
like a marionette.
Palm facing down. This is your left hand. Okay, you got it in front of you about chest level. Now bring it up to your chin. Okay, I'm trying to do this and talk to the microphone. Bring it up to your chin so that the wrist, the back of your wrist, right where your forearm meets the back of your hand. Okay, you want it to connect with your chin right there. Okay, so kind of like your fingers are like wiggling around like you got a beard blowing in the breeze in front of your face. Okay, now bring your right hand up. And
same way,
bring it up and put it directly underneath, okay, the first hand. So you've got your two hands, one below the other, and they're both kind of adjoined to the base of your chin. Then you just rear your head back. You wiggle all your fingers like they're tentacles, you know, the tentacular mouth of, I don't know if that's a word, but, you know, of Cthulhu. Because if we see these popular artistic depictions of the great elder god, We see his you know, tentacles, you know, growing from his mouth and everything. So you lean back with your fingers like that and everything, and you wiggle them, and you go, and that is how you do the Cthulhu.
So it's basically a squid mixed with Chewbacca.
Yes, exactly. Now,
if any listener out there wants to make a song, send us a song. We have listeners send us music periodically. If anybody wants to make a song to go along with the Cthulhu, feel free, send it to us.
Well, I'm just imagining I'm sitting here, and I know over the next week I'm going to be doing normal things around my place, you know, doing things, and all of a sudden I'll remember this show, and I'll be like,
oh yeah,
I wonder how many people are doing the Cthulhu right now.
it's kind of like in Thriller, you know, where they do that like the Wolfman thing, you know, it's kind of like that. It's like people are looking at each other and, you know, that does sound a little bit too much like Chewbacca. We'll have to come up with a better Cthulhu noise that's easy enough for people to do. yeah, maybe this one.
But you need two hands to make that noise, too.
Yes, exactly. It's very difficult.
So pull out your other two hands.
Yes, right.
And grab your cheeks.
Yeah, just grab your cheeks, pull out, and release very quickly in succinct fashion like this. Maybe we can combine the two. That's Cthulhu. That's the sound. Okay, anyway, you know, but speaking of slimy green things like Cthulhu, Chris, I'm sorry. I know we're almost out of time. Have we got time for one more poem here?
Yes. This one is by Grunthos the Flatulent, scribed by Douglas Adams. This is a poem.
Grunthos the Flatulent.
This is a poem described in his seminal work, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This poem, I finally found the text of it. It's called Ode to a Small Lump of Green Putty I Found in My Armpit One Midsummer Morning. Putty, 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 green putty, grutty peen, grarum pity, morning. Prid summer, groaning utty, discovery, oh. Putty, armpit, armpit putty, not even a particularly nice shade of green.
And thus endeth the reading.
Great.
That's going to become the official poem of the Graylian Report. Oh, boy. That's a perfect one for Valentine's Day, I think. Well, I'm sure those who have suffered long enough with us with our Valentine's poem selection, I think they were pretty good, actually. In fact, one of our listeners just wrote to tell me the following about that. They said, you are really funny and entertaining, you guys. Well, thank you very much for that. I'm glad people find that funny and entertaining. But in terms of some real news, I think we've got a moment to get into this real quick. There have been, for weeks now, we've been hearing about these loud explosions that have been happening around different parts of the world. And in fact, there was one that actually occurred just as recently as the other night. I think specifically we were looking at, when was this? I'm trying to find out the date. I've got it February 13th, so this was probably late in the evening between Sunday into Monday morning. I received an email from a listener who shared the following. He asked, did you hear about that giant meteor last night? At least they were saying it was a meteor, but I've never heard a meteor making a very loud sonic boom like this. Now, this guy wrote from around maybe Greenville, South Carolina. He said, I heard it around 2 a.m. I was still up and inside my house. It was an extremely loud, low-frequency boom, and I could tell it was from far off somewhere. I could tell it was not from some normal source of loud sound that you'd, you know, expect to hear, like a truck or something like that. And he said, what's funny is that the neighbor's house, about 100 yards or so away, they've got a lot of chickens. And he said that when this loud sonic boom occurred in conjunction with this meteor, they were saying, that entered the atmosphere, he said these chickens at the neighbor's house on down the way went berserk. And he sent a couple of links. One of the links was to a WYFF4 news station down, I think they're based out of Greenville as well. WYFF4 reported that the National Weather Service and emergency dispatchers from across the upstate say that they got numerous calls overnight from people who heard a loud explosion that was followed by lights streaking across the sky. In fact, Chris even managed to find some video of this, and we'll have that linked in the show notes for the program this week. Now, apparently staffers have said that they got a call from the Greenville police around 2 a.m. That's exactly when our listener who wrote said that he heard this. They said after they started getting calls, they checked the security camera at the National Weather Service and, in fact, saw a faint, barely recognizable flash of light at approximately 1:42 a.m. The National Weather Service representative told News 4 it may have been a meteor, but that his agency does not investigate those kind of events. Now, NASA would be the source to confirm meteor activity. The agency had not at that time, this was as of yesterday morning, they had not yet returned a call to News 4. In Spartanburg County alone, dispatchers took about 75 calls, and reports are coming in from as far away as Lexington, North Carolina, as well as Carlton, Georgia. Firefighters in the Reedville Fire Department in Spartanburg County witnessed the light show firsthand. They told News 4 it happened at about 1:55 a.m. And a retired astronomer, Doug Geegan, didn't see the light in the sky, but he said based on what he's hearing from everyone, it does sound like a rather unusual meteor. He says people saw a lot of lights in the sky, but what does it really mean? Well, it means that probably there was some kind of thing happening that was out of the ordinary. Geegan said that the event was different than the annual meteor showers, such as the Leonids, which peak every November. Indeed, it was a rather strange circumstance, and I thought how unusual, especially since we've been hearing all these reports coming in from different people about loud noises heard all around the globe. You know, I got a phone call from a friend of mine the other day who was very concerned that she hadn't heard from me in a few days. And the reason why is because right here in Asheville, North Carolina, there have been so many reports about loud noises, inexplicable noises, that people can't seem to, for whatever reason, determine their origin or where they seem to be emanating from. And she was really concerned because she said, I haven't heard from you in a few days. And with all these stories about explosions and things all over the news, I just didn't know what to think. And I calmed her down and I said, well, hey, I haven't literally had time to watch the local news in a few days. And she just said, go to the 13WLOS website and take a look. And sure enough, right here in our hometown, for the Graylian Report, our local news affiliates are talking about the same sorts of things, loud explosions. Now, they haven't seemed to be in occurrence or concurrence with meteors or large flashes of light in the sky. But again, this astronomer, Mr. Geegan, has described this as being a rather unusual event. I think it's rather peculiar and quite unusual on a larger scale that this sort of thing seems to be happening elsewhere too. These reports of loud explosions coming from the sky. Another listener actually wrote in and he shared with me a few entries of anomalous noises from a William Corliss book that deal with similar strange phenomena in nature. Sometimes there are musical sounds that are heard that seem to emanate from the ground or from water and things like that. Who knew that there was a whole subsection within the strange and the unusual that had to do with unexplainable noises in nature? But that, my friends, is exactly what seems to be the case. And whatever the case may be with regard to this loud, very loud explosion heard in South Carolina just a couple of nights ago, it remains apparently unexplained, although it did seem to occur in conjunction with a bright flash streaking through the sky, what some people are calling a UFO. Was it a meteor? And if it was a meteor, why then were these strange noises associated with it? My gut tells me it was some sort of a meteor, but what circumstances could allow for this loud sonic boom people are hearing? Who knows? We'll discuss this and more in the next hour with Mike Cleland.
For most of us, chocolate is a guilty pleasure. Come on, admit it. You've got a sweet tooth just like the rest of us. But if I told you that eating chocolate was actually really good for your health and happiness, you'd probably say I was in La La Land. Hey, I wouldn't argue. Here's why. Every batch of the fine handcrafted chocolates at La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate is made from scratch, using organic, fair trade, and 100% natural ingredients. From the first bite, you'll know you're enjoying true quality, and the heart shape isn't the only way you'll feel the love. In fact, every chocolate from La La Land Organics is made by Melody Dawn Germain herself, and according to her own special recipe. You'll be enjoying Ecuadorian heirloom cacao in every bite, along with a selection of wholesome herbs and superfood supplements that not only make La La Land Organics delicious, but really good for your health and happiness. They're all natural, gluten-free, and no dairy, soy, or refined sugars are included, which help them boost your energy, reduce stress, and promote longevity. And as if healthy organic chocolates didn't remove the guilt factor enough, Melody ships all her orders in reusable, food-grade, non-BPA containers designed to eliminate toxic residue and cut down on environmental waste. Be sure and visit Melody's website at www.mdgnewmedia.com. That website again is mdgnewmedia.com. Just click chocolate in the toolbar at the top of the page. You can't miss it. And while you're there, you can see a full list of the ingredients that will be sure to put a smile on your face. And I promise, it's guilt-free. La La Land Organics Raw Chocolate. Why wait? That website again is mdgnewmedia.com.
The 9/11 memorial is for the 343 firefighters who didn't make it.
For my husband, who died that day.
And the first responders who saved my life.
Because the best of humanity can overcome the worst hate.
This is Robert De Niro. This year, as we open the 9/11 memorial in New York City, we ask that you join us to honor, remember, and reunite. To learn more or to reserve your visit, go to 911memorial.org.
Brought to you by the 9/11 Memorial and the Ad Council.
Theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Gremium Report with your host, Mike Evans.
We're your ambassadors of the unexplained, keeping you company every Tuesday from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time here on the Gremium Report. And of course, for all of you listeners on demand who download the podcast each week, growing by the hundreds literally every week. I'm so thrilled to be able to have such a fantastic base of individuals, bright thinkers who share their insights with me on a weekly basis and help contribute to making this program better and better every week. And that said, we're going to get to a listener email here in just a moment, as well as a very special discussion on synchronicity and hidden experiences with Mike Clellan. But first, I do want to say that if you like what you hear on the Grayling Report and you haven't been over to the website, I highly, highly recommend that you check us out. Just visit www.graliereport.com. When you get to the website, graliereport.com, there are all kinds of things. We provide content. We've also got a donation button. And if you feel it in your heart of hearts, especially here on Valentine's Day, to donate, help this operation sound as good as it possibly can. It's hard to sound much better with fantastic studio staff like I've got here and all those folks involved with this program on a weekly basis. But we do accept your kind contributions from time to time just as well. And you're welcome to send an email to the Grayling Report. You just click that button right there and you can send along your own ideas, your own thoughts, your own observations about the strange and unusual that may affect us in our daily lives. And that said, I'd like to get to an email right now from one of our listeners. This was John from Toronto, Canada, who had written in, and he shared the following with me. He said, "Hi guys, I had a sudden aha moment listening to your recent podcast. It discussed both Von Daniken and Whitley Strieber and others, and how some of them had said that they had seen owls in the space of, you know, maybe just a couple of minutes of each other, often around or in conjunction with strange phenomena." John wrote, "I think that the two discussion points made me think of that ancient city-state of Athens whose symbol was the owl. Indeed, it was on all their coins and seemed to represent wisdom. And like Strieber, could those Athenian philosophers have had contact maybe with owls, or perhaps something that was represented by owls, like greys or visitors, as Strieber calls them? Could that have actually been inspired intellectually by the presence of the owl? Maybe it's just a thought. Thanks, we enjoy the program." Well, we enjoy those kinds of commentaries that we receive from our listeners from time to time. But when I thought about the connection with owls, I thought there's nobody probably who understands owls better than my good friend Mike Clellan of the Hidden Experience blog, who joins us now. Mike, what is it about owls that relates so integrally with strange phenomena and synchronicity?
I do not have a good answer to that. One thing to consider right off is that in the UFO abduction lore, there is something that's referred to as a screen memory. And anyone who's listening to your show has probably got a little bit of a foundation in the literature of the UFO or alien abduction or contact lore. The people who claim the abduction phenomena will often claim seeing owls. And upon deeper investigation, and sometimes that investigation involves hypnotic regression, they will realize that it was not an owl at all. It was actually a gray alien with the large enigmatic eyes. The this, you know, that so a witness may report something that, you know, here I was driving down a lonely road at night and I turned a corner and there standing in the road were 3-4 foot tall owls. The next thing I knew, I was driving along again and I had experienced missing time. That's the kind of story that gets reported over and over again. And upon investigation, those owls turn out not to be owls. That said, very real owls seem to show up in not only my life, but in others. On my blog, I did put out a call to I just put a posting up one time. It's like, hey, if anyone has any owl stories, why don't you send them to me? And I wasn't exactly flooded, but I got, let's say, dozens of very unusual owl stories.
Still pretty significant, though, isn't it? I mean, that's a good number of people who, you know, contacted you and saying, hey, you know, I've had similar experiences and I can't explain those.
Yes. So, you know, and then also just the fact that the owl has a place in mythological lore all across the spectrum, you know, whether that be in Native Americans or whether that be ancient Greeks or Egyptians, the owl does show up as a sort of a totem animal of sorts throughout the histories. And the mythology surrounding the owl isn't always the same. You know, it's in certain Native American tribes, it's a harbinger of bad luck, and mm-hmm. then in other lores, it is seen because it can see at night, because it has those big eyes, and because it's seen at night, it is a key into the other realm. Mm-hmm. It is a gateway into the other realm, and that night vision is the sort of metaphor for that you know, straddling two worlds.
Yeah, the owl. You know, and there's so many strange traditions that are kind of associated with owls and their presence. I mean, one of the obvious ones, you and I have probably discussed this in the past just as well, is the way that the owl in many traditions is believed to, I think you already mentioned being a harbinger of death, but I know that especially in Appalachian folklore, there was this old notion that if an owl showed up and lit outside your window and sat there and watched people, that it meant that there would be a death soon in the family. But you see that kind of story in a lot of different traditions. A lot of different cultures seem to accept the owl maybe as, you know, some sort of a kind of partially supernatural being itself, something that, like you said, straddles, you know, a bit of both worlds.
And it's also, in if anyone has seen an owl up close, and I have, they are very, they're very big, strong, beautiful bird, but there's something very haunt, very spooky about them. And I think that everyone would recognize that in seeing an owl, whether that be me or, you know, an ancient Egyptian, you know, seeing an owl, I'm quite certain they would have the same, you know, that it would strike the same chord deep inside them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The owls also I see in a lot of cultures, and not just owls, but birds of prey in general. You see this a lot in the therianthropic representations of humans with animal heads and things. For instance, in ancient Egypt, there were owls and falcons and creatures like that that were often represented because these birds were also associated with strength and power and things like that. And then, of course, as John, the listener who had written in with the question about owls, had said, he had pointed out that, you know, in the Athenian, I think that there were some, you know, different kinds of, you know, currency and things like that used in ancient Greece that incorporated the owl and the imagery of the owl. But now here's where it gets kind of funny and into the realm of what we'd call synchronicity. I remember once you and I were talking, Mike, and this is why I always enjoy your insights on things, because I'm the kind of person who often, my experience, you know, in life, especially with relation to strange and unusual things, is a bit lacking. I'm pretty boring in that regard. But by the same token, I remember you asked me once, well, have you ever experienced something synchronistic or synchronicity? Something just an incredible coincidence. I said, oh, I have that happen all the time. And you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And yet you say that you don't have things happen. And it's funny how I think a lot of people will make a distinction between what I tend to refer to as the more subtle essences of the strange and unusual versus, you know, the have you seen a Sasquatch? Have you seen a UFO or a ghost or a goblin or something like that? Very seldom do we look at something like the owl and the role it plays in culture and the symbolism associated with that and think, my gosh, you know, where does all that come from? Why is it that in abductee reports, guys like Whitley Strieber talk about literally waking up the morning following, you know, what we presume was, you know, a literal, you know, being taken from his room, if we're to believe literally what Whit was talking about in the book Communion, being taken from his room and taken aboard some sort of a vessel and examined by some non-human intelligence. He was very careful to say what they were also. But in his experiences, the morning after, he often remembered, you know, again, just seeing like what looked like a great big barn owl or something landing on the windowsill and staring at him with these large black eyes. So, you know, there's something about the prevalence of these things in relation to strange phenomena and the way that our mind interprets the relationship with things that we don't understand, maybe things that terrify us even, and the presence of the owl. Again, it's like a go-between maybe between these strange elements of our existence.
Whitley Strieber once commented that the owl with its large eyes may be a he has a funny way of he's ever the poet in a way.
Oh yes.
And it's there's sometimes he blurs the line a little bit about, you know, like whether he's speculating or whether he's talking from some sense of deep knowing. But he said that the owl has the capability where they, you know, the visitors, the aliens, can see through the owl's eyes. So the owl is almost a tool, not unlike a video surveillance camera, where they can tap into those large night vision eyes. And then they can, so the visitors don't have to actually travel here. They can just, for instance, whether it's through telepathic means or whether they switch a little switch in their little flying saucer somewhere, but they can then see through the eyes of the owl. Now, I have absolutely no idea whether that's true or not, but that is a little spooky little, you know, interesting way to contemplate the mystery of the owl.
Yeah. Whit always, as you point out, he has a very unique way with words. And, you know, I think that there are many times in his books where it's difficult to tell, you know, whether he means something very literally or whether there is intended to be some sort of a kind of, you know, a philosophical or, you know, kind of a symbolic allusion being made to something. Another animal that makes its certain kind of prevalence in his own experience was the wolf. I remember there was that experience that he described in the book where he's traveling by train, and he also, I think, looks out the window and has a remembrance of seeing a wolf sitting on top of a hill howling or something like that. And, you know, whatever it is, it's this connection with creatures of the night. And I'll share something with you real quick also with regard to wolves. I know that we're supposed to be talking about owls here, but because Strieber mentioned wolves, I got to mention my own wolf story too. There was only one time when I was a kid ever that I had a really, truly terrifying dream. I mean, like, wakes you up from bed and you're screaming and crying and you don't know where you are and what you're experiencing. Now, in this experience of mine, I remember looking to the edge of the bed. I was just about like 4 or 5 years old. I was just really small. But I remember distinctly in the dream, waking up and thinking that everything in the room was exactly as it should have been. I mean, I was awake. I could recognize everything in the room with me. And there at the edge of the bed is a wolf. But it's not really like a wolf, like the animal. I mean, like, I see the face, the ears, and the big yellow saucer-shaped eyes staring directly at me. This wolf, he's peering, you know, all I can see is from the nose up at the foot of the bed, staring directly at me. And it scared the living hell out of me. I woke up. I was so terrified that for the entire next day, I was convinced and I accused my father of having gone in there and done something, put on a mask or something to try and scare me. That's how real this dream was. And again, there's this image of the wolf, you know, which I thought was kind of funny. Now, you know, I mentioned this to people in abduction circles and they're like, now, Micah, I don't know. That sounds a lot like, you know, some of these experiences that the abductees describe. I don't have any other, you know, kind of link in my mind to alien abductions and things like that. Bill and Nancy Burns have kind of thought maybe I did at some point. I don't feel that that's the case. I know others who do, but I thought that it was strange, again, that in this dream that I had, truly probably the very most terrifying dream I've ever experienced, it was a wolf at the edge of my bed staring at me with big yellow eyes like it was going to come eat me or something.
I have heard one wolf story, which is interesting, in conjunction with the alien abduction phenomena, where and this is a private story, and I don't want to share too much, so I'm going to keep a lot of the details hidden
sure.
here. So three people standing on a street corner in a city, they look up, they see a bright light, and they're like, huh, what is that? The next thing they know, all of them, the two people wake up in their bed, and then they connect up later that day and then explain what happened. You know, like, wait a minute, all of us were standing on the corner. So the third person is a young woman, and she was standing on the street corner, sees the bright light. The next thing she knows, she's driving near her own home. She's very close to a boyfriend's home, and it's late at night. It was, let's say, midnight when they saw the bright light, and now it's 3 a.m. She is very close to his house, so she drives to his house, pounds on the door. He opens the door immediately and says, I was waiting for you. And later, she's sitting with him. She has a relationship with him that is tense in some ways. And then she sees him, watches him morph into a werewolf.
Huh.
She watches him. He morphs into a werewolf. They're sitting there, and then he morphs back into his regular person. And she's obviously quite shaken. Her eyes are, showing the shock and emotion. And he looks at her and says, "Ooh, you saw that, didn't you?" Now those details are things that if I was to make up a story about, like, alien abduction, I would not include that, or let's say UFO abduction. This is so murky. I use that catchphrase sometimes, and I really don't have a good answer to what it might be. But that's the kind of story that one hears, and that's also the kind of story that does not show up in, let's say, late night television documentaries that are trying to depict the same phenomena.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, Mike. You know, and that's the thing is that, you know, when you dig into a lot of this sort of stuff, something I've noticed and something that I know very well by now is that if you really study what abductees say versus what the media portrayal of alien abduction and these sorts of scenarios often really entail, I think that you begin to find differences, a lot of differences. And in fact, I think that sometimes some of the most relevant details, some of the most important facets of these strange symbolic experiences are left out by the really hardcore nuts and bolts, aliens are taking people and experimenting on them type researchers. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion with Mike Cleland about synchronicity, owls, and esoterica here on the Graylian Report.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
They flutter in the night. They're not bats. They're not even moths. No, they're owls. And I think that it's something that is less often explored in terms of understanding the strange and the unusual is the strange relationship that we as humans have with odd creatures of the night, specifically those known as the owl. You know, the Mothman is a character that is very well known, and yet most people aren't aware of the fact that there was also allegedly a creature seen in the UK called the Owl Man. Our guest this hour is Mr. Mike Cleland, who's joining us to discuss this subject a good bit because he's had a number of these sorts of experiences himself, and he discusses them at his website. And Mike, actually, so that I don't mess it up, would you go ahead and give us that website address for the listeners, please?
Okay, the website is hiddenexperience, all one word, .blogspot.com. And if you just type in Hidden Experience blog into Google, it comes right up.
Excellent. Mike, you know, are you familiar with the stories of the Owl Man and maybe what that kind of has to do with all this stuff? Was that like a Mothman type creature? Can those stories even be taken seriously?
You know, I've only read a little bit about it, and it's my understanding it has the same flavor as the Mothman events that took place in Point Pleasant in the late 60s. And this took place in England. And so I can't really speak to that, except I definitely know it had the same flavor. And the actually winged creature was referred to as Owl Man mm-hmm. in that lore, as opposed to the moniker it got in West Virginia.
You know, and the funny thing about the West Virginia Mothman creature is that by a lot of the eyewitness reports, if they're to be taken literally again, because I think that there's a lot more to the Mothman mystery than literally just the presence of a great big bird-like thing. You know, I think even John Keel said that there were probably a whole different host of different kinds of things going on that were all lumped into one apparently interrelated phenomenon, which we refer to as Mothman. But that said, there were a lot of reports that described the thing as looking a lot like a great big owl.
Very much so, and that would be why, if it was the same creature, let's say, that would be, you know, how it would have gotten that name in England.
Absolutely.
And I think that was in the very early 70s, if I'm not mistaken, that it showed up in England, and I may be wrong.
And whether or not there was an actual physical creature, again, I'm just interested that there's this parallel. Even if somebody flat out made that up, what is it about the owl that draws people to the to their expressions of weirdness like that? You know, and that seems to be something that's so consistent. You yourself, and I know that this is, you know, a fairly personal subject for you discussing owls, because you have had a number of interesting experiences. You discuss some of those at your blog. You know, what have your own experiences been with regard to owls and synchronicity and the unusual, the hidden experiences, as you like to call them?
To tell this story correctly, I'll just tell you where the first time I experienced the owls. Now, just so you know, I do live in a place with a lot of owls. I live in the Northern Rockies in rural Idaho, so there are a lot of owls here. And so let me just tell this one story, and then it kind of typical of any of these things that kind of weave all over the place, but there is an interconnectedness to all this.
Okay.
I went out camping with a friend, and this was a young woman that I had just met, and I basically said, hey, I go out camping all the time. I go out for one night. If the weather's clear, I don't bother taking a tent. We sleep out under the stars. It's beautiful. And, you know, we can leave late at night, or not, excuse me, late in the afternoon, and then just come back in the morning. And the terrain that's around me, the Grand Teton National Park, is right out my window pretty much. So, you know, that it's quite beautiful. So we get out there. We are walking along. I didn't know her that well. And we stop. It's sun is setting. I'm making dinner on a little camp stove, and we're having a conversation. I realize that this person that I'm talking with, her name is Kristen, is quite. I'm quite impressed. All of a sudden the conversation gets really deep, and I realize this is a smart, insightful person. And then at that moment, an owl starts flying above us. And then a second owl, and then a third owl.
Oh, wow.
And we literally watch the sun go down. These owls are flying around. They're landing on tree branches near us. They're looking down at us. We lie down under the stars. Now, owls are extremely quiet. They have alternating feathers where there's almost like a down feather in between each of their flight feathers. What it does is makes them extremely quiet when they fly. So we were laying down on our backs, looking up at the, you know, the abundance of stars that you get at the high elevation in the Rockies here, and just spectacular. And then the owls would swoop down silently, getting really what it felt like really close to our faces, and then the stars would black out for just a second. It was extraordinary. So the next day, you know, we're both kind of like shaken, like, wow, that was really incredible. And we say, let's go out and camp again. So I think it was 4 or 5 days later, we go camping at an entirely different spot. And this time it's the weather is a little bit cooler, and we have and it's cold enough that we're a little chilly, and the sun is setting. And I say, let's just hike up to that that little hilltop right there and get a view. We can watch the sunset, and then we can come back down, and just that little bit of a walk will warm us up before we go into the climb into the shelter. And she says, great. So we walk up in the twilight, and we stand on top of this beautiful hilltop. We're probably at about well over 10,000 feet in elevation. And at that elevation, the trees are kind of scrubby and short, so there's not really tall trees around. And beautiful view of the sunset, and then one owl lands, two owl lands, and then a third owl land. And so that within 4 days, we have two different sightings with three owls that basically come and hang out with us. So once again, we spent about a half hour there until it was too dark to really see much. We had our flashlights so we could walk back down to the shelter. But these owls basically just stood there and watched us from very close proximity. You know, both of us were pretty shaken. We were like totally Googling spirit animals and things like that when we got back to town. Right. And then I think it was well over a year later, I contacted Kristen, who later moved out of town, and I said, do you remember? Actually, it was when I was writing up the story. I was writing up the story for one of the very initial blog postings on my blog, which would have been in 2009. And I think this event took place in 2007. So I called her up and I said, do you remember what we were talking about the night we were talking, you know, when we first saw the owls the very first time? Because I remember we were talking about something profound. And she said right away, she said, oh, yes, I remember. I was trying to describe my deepest definition of God. And that's when they appeared. Now, this is the kind of thing that is, it's sort of, it's not truly a synchronicity, but it is sort of a profound, almost mystical event. And then to get tied into, you know, the definition of God was you know, made it all the experience all that more rich.
I would have to say so. And man, I tell you, you know, owls, I have heard at times that people will say that owls can tend to be maybe kind of curious. But, you know, I mean, when you have experience after experience where three, you know, owls are showing up and just hanging out. I mean, they were just...
I have an experience where I was with a friend, and we were camping with a big group, and it's grizzly bear terrain where I live. So, you know, some people were hanging the food in the trees, and there was a little pond near us, but the water was kind of murky. And I remembered that there was a little spring on the trail back a ways. So I said, oh, listen, we're going to go back, take everyone's water bottles. We'll fill up the water bottles, and we'll come back here. And then everyone will have nice clean water rather than this sort of murky swamp water. So they're doing a nice thing. And then we go off to do a nice thing. And this altruistic thing is part of it, as far as like somehow that's interconnected. So we carry all the, you know, take backpacks, take all the water bottles, fill them all up. And the fellow that I'm walking with, we have what amounts to a really deep conversation about, you know, synchronicities, about UFOs, about the meaning of life. And then we get back to our campsite, and the people are still off in the trees. You can hear them thrashing around off in the distance, setting up the bear hang with some cord. And then we are at the little campsite, which is this tiny little clearing, this little meadow in among the trees. And we this is – now here's the odd thing, and I can't explain this. Both of us did something without saying anything to each other. We both laid on our backs and looked straight up at the sky. And so in essence, we're sort of looking up into a, you know, looking straight up the sky. We can only see through this small little circle, this tiny little meadow. As we lay down, there's literally a crashing coming out high in the trees. And five owls flew around us, above us, in this twilight for about probably less than a half hour, more like 20 minutes. And that's the most owls I've ever seen at one time.
Wow.
And I've seen three owls, just like that other story I've told a bunch of times. And I've talked to owl biologists, which they have here in, close to Yellowstone National Park. And I've talked to them. I said, here's my experiences. And they kind of look at me and they shake their head. And I say, is this normal? And they're like, nope. I've never heard of this stuff before.
Why are they so drawn to you, Mike?
I have no idea. So, all I can say is that, if I treat it like a synchronicity, which I would just have to say, just to pay attention. And I've heard one person, his name is Alan Abadassa Green, who wrote or edited a book on synchronicity. And his take on synchronicities is that they are, it's a compass bearing, when you're on a boat on the ocean, there's really no way to tell which way is north and south if you don't have, the sun up. So to do any sort of traveling, you have to have a compass bearing. And he said, these are just giving you an indication of a direction to travel in. And so on almost all of these occasions, what led up to these was either profound conversations, literally like the definition of God, or like a deep spiritual recognition that, like the wilderness was magical. And so I just have to trust that those are important. Those are something to pay attention to. And that's actually one of the questions I ask. I've been doing a lot of UFO research. And one of the questions I've started to ask, which I don't think is on like the MUFON checklist of things to ask, is, so someone says, we were sitting in the backyard and then I looked up and I saw a UFO. And I'll ask, what were you talking about right before you saw the UFO? And this just happened the other night in a conversation, and the person says, it's funny you should ask that, because what I was talking about is I was very adamant and I was very agitated, and I said the movie The Fourth Kind, which is about UFO abductions mm-hmm. and owls, and also quite exploitative. He had just seen it, and he was talking to his friend, and he was making sort of a passionate speech saying that that movie did a disservice to the UFO abduction lore because it treated it as just a scary monster movie. And he was, he basically was on his high horse saying, that the UFO abduction lore is something very serious and shouldn't be taken lightly and shouldn't be treated so cavalierly and so, silly as it was in that movie. And that's what he was talking about right before he and this other person had what amounted to a profound UFO experience in the backyard.
Interesting. It brings to mind that idea that there's some seeming element to all this that involves an interaction between those who are witnessing the phenomenon and then the phenomena itself. And I have to just say, let's make a brief note and aside here. I really kind of agree with the sentiment of that individual with regard to The Fourth Kind. As a horror film, maybe it's okay, but so many of these UFO-type films, and Matt Oakley, our engineer, is over here, shaking his head. He doesn't think it was a good movie at all.
No, it was horrible.
But the thing is that so many of these films, so many of the ones that deal with UFOs, Fire in the Sky was the same way. That, if you read Travis Walton's Encounter and you compare that with what is in that film, there is very little similarity aside from the fact that they're out in the woods, they see the thing, he runs up underneath it, and he disappears for a few days. What took place on board the ship was a complete fabrication. It was rewritten because it wasn't scary enough the way that Travis told it in the book. And you see that so often in films and television and media portrayals of alien abduction, which is, again, why I say even a lot of the books that deal with this sort of thing don't really canvas all the elements that could be associated with it, namely the symbolic elements that are kind of, interlaced within the experience. And that's, again, why we're taking one element of that tonight, the owl angle, and kind of looking at that a little more closely. One of our listeners wrote in tonight, and he said, before I called tonight, I was wanting to share with you a synchronicity within a synchronicity. Last night, my wife and I were watching Bodyguard, which was, of course, it was being aired as a tribute to the late singer Whitney Houston, who's passed away just this week. A part of the film had a call of an owl that appeared in several scenes throughout the movie. And my wife said, "Did you hear that owl?" She said she's aware that the owl is, of course, a sign of death, which was a belief in the Old Testament times. We discussed that earlier on the program just as well. And he said, "You mentioned synchronicity and owls." I thought, what a weird combination. And then it hit me. Wow, this in itself is kind of a synchronicity within a synchronicity. Y'all have a great night and be blessed, Mr. Mike. So that's kind of interesting too. And that was something that I noticed just the other day when I was thinking about this, and my whole reason for having you on the program tonight to look at the owl thing, Mike, was that what we had with our the initial email, I think it was John from Toronto that wrote in and was talking about owls and things. I just put an article up at grayleanreport.com, and if you go to the Grayling Report, you can actually see that. It links to another article that was sent to me by my friend David Jones, editor of New Dawn magazine in Australia. And sure enough, I go to look at that article. Now, this is, again, an image that I posted with this article before the email exchange with the gentleman from Canada. And there's this trickster character. He looks like a jester, and he's holding up a mirror in one hand, and on his right hand there is, of course, an owl sitting there. And I'm thinking, you know, it's so funny how these things, you know, like they tend to happen in threes. And that indeed was, for me, kind of a small synchronicity as well. Next thing we know, there's going to be an owl flying to somebody's living room, and they're going to call in and tell us about this, probably. That seems to be the way it happens, huh?
Yeah, strangely enough, that is exactly the way it seems to unfold, is it unfolds with these, you know, like synchronicities are almost like describing dreams, mm-hmm. where to tell them correctly, you know, they you have to go through so much backstory. Like, here's what the synchronicity meant, because, you know, here's what led up to it, and here's the connecting string. And oftentimes, you know, it's so personalized that it won't mean anything unless it's, you know, the person telling the synchronicity may not be able to share the power that it had to him as an individual. That's mm-hmm. certainly my experience.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. I think that's part of the entire nature of synchronicity in itself, is that the synchronicity only has meaning or apparent meaning because it is, again, something that that appears as a link or a relationship or something that you know builds, I guess we might say, a relationship between two otherwise unrelated things. For there to be some sort of a importance that can be drawn between two separate elements or occurrences, there has to, of course, you know, be some sort of a symbolism, where there has to be some sort of a meaning that the individual interprets, which, again, you know, I want to be careful. I don't want to say that, you know, we can pull quantum physics into it and say that the act of observing our reality on a quantum level applies to real life, because a lot of people say that, you know, the quantum physicists, rather, will point out to you that what we observe on the quantum level does not directly pertain to how things seem to occur in real life, but or in the physical world as we, you know, perceive it on a day-to-day basis. But that said, again, I don't think you can deny, in reports of strange and unusual occurrences and happenings, that there seems to be a very interactive element. And it all comes back to what we as the viewers, you know, we as those who are perceiving the phenomena, make of it, how we interpret it, you know, and how, what kind of culture is built around it. You know, I was talking with my brother last night, and we were talking about ghosts and everything, and he said he never wanted to live in a haunted house. And I said, well, you know, I would say I wouldn't be, you know, opposed to that. And the reason why is because I don't think I'm bothered by the idea of what we culturally refer to as a ghost as much as other people, because I think indeed the idea of a disembodied spirit of the dead is something that maybe we project onto the phenomenon, whereas indeed what we could be experiencing is some sort of a physical anomaly, some sort of a rent in space-time that allows some individual from a past epoch, you know, to appear in our own reality temporarily, and maybe even allows for temporary interaction with them. Now, I don't know that could, you know, seek to explain all instances where people claim to see what they perceive as being a spirit of the dead, but the point is that, you know, again, is it really that ghosts are spirits of the dead, or are we interacting with a phenomena that we interpret to the best of our ability, and culturally, the label we place on what we call ghosts, and therefore the fear that we derive from that experience is from the perception of them as a spirit, you know, an undead, you know, personage or something like that, you know? So, again, I think it all comes down to the nature of the individual and how we perceive the experience as it's occurring and playing out before us.
So, can I tell a story?
Absolutely, please.
Okay, this is exactly the kind of thing that's a little complicated. There's a collision of so many different elements in the story, including owls, that it just leaves me perplexed to try to give it any sort of meaning. First, let me explain that this took place in 2009, and I know the date exactly. It happened on October 3rd. And I know that because on October 4th, I had planned to have a psychic reading with a psychic, and her name is Marla Fries. And I had, and she's sort of popular, and she's booked up way in advance. So it took me months to get this psychic reading. And that was for Sunday, October 4th. Now, on Saturday, October 3rd, the day before, I get up, I sort of tootling around on the internet, and I find this website called Synchronicity. And the story of the day was a guy who was just a little essay, typical sort of blog posting, and it was about a guy who was having money troubles with his wife, and he sort of storms out of his house and goes down to the river to go fishing just to clear his mind. And he an owl flies over him and drops something shiny in the water. And he sort of wades out into the water and finds it in the rocks, in the shallow water, and it's a money clip with his initials on it. So oh, really? I thought that was a very interesting article, you know, like that's a, wow, that's a perfect synchronicity. And I was going to leave a comment on it just because I'm, you know, fascinated by owls and I'm fascinated by synchronicities. So I scroll down, but before I could leave a comment, I found another comment, and it was from a woman, and she said, "Hey, I had an owl experience once. I was in a meadow where 50 owls were surrounding me. It was the most mystical experience of my life." And I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not, you know, so all, now I'm sidetracked, right? So I was going to do one thing, and I, and then I click on this woman, you know, typical of, you know, modern, you know, this is the 21st century. So I clicked on her little avatar, and just a blonde woman with sunglasses. And it took me to her website. And then from there, I got her email. And I sent her an email and basically say, like, listen, I want to hear more about this story with these 50 owls. And then she replies right away. She says, "Oh, I wrote it up as a creative writing essay once, and so I posted it on my blog. Here's the link to my blog, and I just posted it just now, just because you reminded me of it." So I go to her blog. I read this essay, which is nicely written. It's very mysterious, very spooky, and she writes about being in this meadow with 50 owls and a man named Christian. Now, part of her little essay, which I didn't get into in my other one, was she's with a man named Christian, and she sort of, she doesn't sort of, she very much writes like the, she's basically longing for the first kiss with this guy Christian. Mm-hmm. And what I did not share with my story with, I guess I implied it, I certainly shared it when I wrote it on my blog posting, is my experience with the woman Kristen. I was you know, sort of in that same point. I'm like, good grief, this woman is very impressive. And I wrote it in a way, you know, like you don't have to read between the lines, but it's certainly implying that I was longing for that first kiss. Now, so I write back to her and I say, wow, that's a really beautiful story. So the story involves basically her and her friend, you know, walking through the woods. They come into a clearing and there are 50 owls sort of ringing. She says approximately 50 owls ringing the trees, looking down at them. Now I, you know, so I say, wow, that's an interesting story. And then she emails right back and she says, you know, a funny thing happened when Christian and I were driving home from our walk in the woods, we saw a UFO.
Oh, well.
And I go, what? You know, like, do you, my, you know, I have a website and it's all about UFOs, owls, and synchronicities. And then she emails back right away. And it's funny, these emails are coming back, you know, fast and furious. There's, we don't really wait between them. And she, I didn't know anything about her at all. And she said, oh, you know who you need to talk to? You need to talk to my friend Marla Fries. She's tapped in. Now, to sort of dissect that set of events, I mean, there's multiple owl stories. There's the weird longing between Christian and Kristen, you know, that takes place before the author of these blog posts. There's the UFO element. And then there's this, this premonition of her telling me that I need to talk to Marla Fries, and I had an appointment with her, you know, less than 24 hours later.
Unbelievable.
Now, I'll just jump ahead. Now, Marla Fries was supposed to talk to me at 1 o'clock, and she calls me up at 10:30 in the morning, And she basically kind of says, she kind of sounds mad. I've never talked to her ever. She sounds mad. And she says, what the hell is going on? You know, like, what is going on? Like, I am like, you know, like, I'm getting downloaded with so much stuff right now. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't know what's going on. And she's like, okay, you have to come. And this is very, she's, you know, very new agey, but she kind of, you know, kind of grilled me a little bit. And she said, I don't know what's going on, but you have to come to this psychic session with an open heart chakra. And I'm like, oh, okay. So a little, you know, so I didn't know what to do. I sat on the couch for a little while and just went, okay, whew, open heart chakra, open heart chakra. And then the appointment was supposed to be at a 1, and she calls me at 11 a.m. And she says, okay, I can't stand this anymore. We're starting right now. And she says that's never happened to her before, where she had that kind of incredible, you know, the way she described it, it felt like her little spirit guides who were in, you know, who she works with as far as her psychic skills were sort of, you know, ringing the alarm bell, basically saying, like, this has to happen now. And she said that never happened before. I don't know how much to read into that. I will say that it was very, I wish I had recorded this session. It was really interesting. And I was very impressed with her skills. She was saying things that she would have had no way of knowing, you know, independently. So.
Wow, that's incredible. That really is a good story. Mike, can you hang with us for the last segment? We've got about maybe 6 minutes left.
Sure.
Excellent. Well, we will come back to this conversation right after this here on the Grayling Report. You know, I wonder sometimes, and I just have to put this out there right before we actually get to this break, that occasionally it does seem, doesn't it, that we are meant to meet certain people, and we are meant to fall into these funny circumstances with individuals, you know. And I would say that if it weren't for the gentleman joining us on the line here, Mike Cleland, right now, I might not have begun to really look at my own synchronistic experiences quite the way that I do. I hope that other people find that same kind of insight from this discussion here on the Grayling Report. We'll be back right after this.
Bob Tarmac, InceptionRadioNetwork.com. I'm going to clue you into a show that I listen to every single week. It's Inception Radio with Jamie Haneke. It airs Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Jamie always brings on new guests every single week on a variety of topics. UFOs, it's paranormal, it's time travel, conspiracy theory, it's everything. And Jamie covers it in depth. When does it begin? It's Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. I'll see you there.
It's the Grayling Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Grayling Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grayling Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
You know, we said it would be a 30-minute section of the program that we would do with Mike Cleland, but when Mike and I get to talking, you know, they call me the mouth of the South, but, you know, you get Mike and I together and there's going to be a long conversation. That's just a guarantee, and I'm sure that everyone enjoys it. You know, Mike, you're so insightful, and your approaches to this subject matter, it's something that I truly appreciate, and I think that other people who look for, you know, things of a little substance in terms of their understanding of Fortiana and phenomenology, I think they recognize that in your own research. And so before we end this chat with you, I did want to give you an opportunity real quick to, you know, talk about anything else that you've got going on and where people can find out more about you and your work.
I'm not sure. So the blog is the main resource I have, and that's I'll give the URL one more time. It's hiddenexperience.blogspot.com, and you can just type in hidden experience blog, and it comes right up on Google. Now, I've also been doing a bunch of audio interviews, which I don't have any kind of schedule for. I do them anytime I feel like it, and I only really do them when I feel motivated. And you were on one, and I don't have any time count on those things. So so that's what I have been putting a lot of work into over the last few years. And as far as the owl thing, it's very interesting. The owl thing has been kind of a nice, I almost want to say like a calling card in a way, where there was a certain point I was seeing so many owls, and I sort of had to delineate like the owl that's off on a fence way off to the side. You know, like I was basically, hey, that does not count. I'm not paying attention to that owl. So I literally said out loud, I said to the universe, I said, listen, I'm not going to pay attention to an owl unless it crosses my path. And then I think less than 48 hours, I was riding later, I was riding my bike through the little town I live in, and an owl swooped down from one tree and landed on another tree, you know, like basically gliding down in the way and crossed my path right at about eye level, fairly close to me, close enough that it seemed a little absurd that I had made that plea to the universe, you know, less than 2 days before. Huh. And since then, I have been taking the mode of owls as well as synchronicities. You know, I mean, some of them could be written off as coincidence, sure. But what I have done is I have made an effort to document these things and then put them on the blog. And some of them are very interesting. Some of them are sort of fleeting. But I feel the act of documentation and sharing them in such a public forum has its own sort of power. And so I just find that the flavor of the synchronicity is something that I have learned to trust more, and then to follow it a little more. Whether some people call it breadcrumbs, some people call it you know, the compass bearing, some people call it a fork in the path. You know, the synchronicities are giving me information, and I am making a very real effort to trust that information, and then to sort of organize my life in a way and truly follow these synchronicities. And what it has done, it has allowed me to, I feel like, to get a little more immersed in these esoteric subjects in a way with a little more heart, I guess is one way to put it. And it's been extremely rewarding. It's been challenging in a lot of ways because it's taken me down some paths I don't think I would have gone down without the gentle nudging of these synchronicities.
You know, in that sense, you're almost an intuitive, I think, you know, looking for little pokes and jabs from, you know, the corners and from the shadows, however they choose to present themselves to you, and then involving yourself in those kinds of things, you know, in a very real way. So, Mike, again, thank you so much for joining us here on the Grailian Report.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate it always, my friend, and it's always a pleasure to talk with you. And with that, we'll wrap up this hour of the program. When we come back, we'll be digging into some news stories and more of this strangeness, high strangeness from around the globe, as we like to talk about it here on the program. So anyway, my friends, stay tuned. We'll be back with a little bit of that here in just a moment here on the Grailian Report, and also maybe a little bit more about these weird noises, these large sounds and things like that going on. Cloaking technology. God, there's so many different things we could tie into all this. But that said, the third and final hour will be reserved for news, and we'll also open the phone lines in case anyone wants to try and jump in and chat with us tonight on the Grailian Report. I'm Micah Hanks, the Mouth of the South. We'll be back again right after this. Micah Hanks of the Grailian Report here. I just wanted to take a minute, well, really just 30 seconds, to tell you a little about a wonderful project I'm privileged to be a part of these days. It's called Intrepid Magazine. Intrepid is an eclectic melting pot of a variety of different areas of interest, ranging from politics and fringe science to mysteries of the unexplained. You'll hear from authors like Nick Redfern, April Slaughter, Marie D. Jones, and Larry Flaxman, editor and publisher Scotty Roberts, and, of course, yours truly. It's Intrepid Magazine, boldly going. Period. Subscribe today. Visit www.intrepidmag.com.
Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From the dark heart of the Appalachian Mountains, live from the Grailian Bunker, welcome back. It's the third and final hour of this week's edition of the Grailian Report. Happy Valentine's Day to all you West Coast listeners who are just now joining the program. I know, we got 10.05 p.m. Eastern Time right now, which puts it right at about 7. People are probably sitting down to have dinner, getting home from work, chillaxing a little bit, and tuning into their favorite weekly weird here on the Grailian Report. And we're always welcoming those of you who are new listeners to the program. That said, we're going to do a little news this hour, and one of the things that's been on my mind, we always like to look at the weird space stuff, you know? We've talked about loud explosions that have been going on all over the place. Who knows what's going on with that, but something that has always fascinated me, specifically, has been the discussion of dark matter. You know, in other words, what we can't account for in terms of the physicality of space, we come up with this idea, this notion of antimatter or dark matter existing, which may or may not be the case, but according to fizzorg.com, maybe there actually is what we call antimatter. Maybe it actually does exist. In fact, researchers at the University of Tokyo's Institute for the Physics and Mathematics of the Universe and Nagoya University used large-scale computer simulations recently, along with observational data of gravitational lensing, that's something we'll have to delve into all into itself, in order to reveal how dark matter is distributed around different galaxies. The new research concludes that galaxies have no definite edges, and that instead galaxies have long outskirts of dark matter that extend to nearby galaxies, and the intergalactic space is not actually empty, but filled with this dark matter. Very interesting. You know, it's well known that there's a large amount of unseen matter, according to this article, called dark matter, and I would assert that it is well presumed. It's well known that the leading theory with regard to the absence of physical matter that is observable, and yet the forces and the effects that they tend to, that matter would exert on it, you know, on other forms throughout the universe. These sorts of things we see, we experience, we can perceive, even in the absence of what we would expect, where physical matter should be found in parts of the universe, and therefore there's this notion that maybe antimatter exists, and that there are very subtle interrelationships between attractant forces exerted by matter and antimatter throughout parts of the universe. So the article says it is well known that there is a large amount of unseen matter, which accounts for these kinds of strange forces and the like, and this is called dark matter. It constitutes about 22% of the present-day universe, while ordinary matter constitutes only 4.5%. Now, an important question does still remain, though. Where is most of the dark matter in the universe? Now, Einstein's general theory of relativity predicts that a light ray passing near a massive object such as a galaxy is bent by the effect called gravitational lensing. For example, the effect causes the image of a distant galaxy to be deformed and brightened by an intervening galaxy. However, the effect itself is very small and so cannot be easily detected for something like a single galaxy unto itself. So only recently, images of millions of galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, or SDSS, made it possible to derive an averaged mass distribution around the galaxies. Earlier in 2010, an international research group led by Bryce Minard, then at University of Toronto, and Masataka Fukujita at IPMU, used 24 million galaxy images from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and successfully detected gravitational lensing effects. This is something we said we'd come back to. They successfully detected what are called gravitational lensing effects that are caused by dark matter around galaxies. And from this result, they determined that the projected matter density distribution over a distance of 100 million light years from the center of galaxies. In other words, they're able to determine, again, the essence of where dark matter may fall in various parts of the universe. They claim to have literally located what might be referred to as missing
dark matter. But the thing is again, there's one problem that I have with this article. Maybe I see what they were kind of saying, but I don't like the way that they said it. It is well known that there is a large amount of unseen matter called dark matter in the universe. Isn't that kind of contradictory? It is well known that there is a large amount of unseen matter. It is well known that the invisible man is standing there fondling himself in the corner. We can't see him, but...
No, that's Matt.
Whoops.
He just thinks when he's naked, he's invisible.
Matt, put your pants on!
Only if you guys don't look at me.
But the thing is, does anyone else, truly, does anyone else have an issue with this whole notion of it is well known that there are things that no one can see and that we can only guess about the physical, literal existence of, and yet this is accepted as the very fundamental basis of science as we know it, at least in some capacities. I mean, dark matter has become a foundation of physics today. And again, I think that portions of what we understand about antimatter, dark matter, aspects of the mystery, again, are speculative. You know, the notion that unseen matter exists to account for certain effects that are observable in our universe, again, is a very likely scenario. But again, there are elements that are associated with that that are quite speculative. And so it bothers me that there's this notion that it is well known, it is well accepted that this is what's going on. I mean, that just, something about that doesn't really set incredibly well with me. I don't know if maybe I'm just complaining too much. Maybe I'm the only person who has a problem with that. I have a strong feeling, though, that I'm probably not the only person who has issue with statements like that. You know, because if you tell me that I'm too speculative because I want to talk about things that people see and encounter and experience every day and talk about, you know, and yet... And what I'm talking about specifically are, of course, strange phenomena, the unusual, the unexplained. And yet when I choose to talk about these kinds of things, I am accused of being too speculative. I'm accused of being, you know, weird, strange, you know, speculative. I have an issue with that, and I think there are a lot of people who have issues with that. You know, someone else who probably has an issue with that. Someone who has remained somewhat unseen but out there in the fringes of the strange and the unusual for a while is none other than Nancy Planetta. Nancy, welcome to the Graylian Report. I wanted to get you on just for a moment tonight because this Thursday you are relaunching everyone's favorite program with everyone's favorite Wiccan Vincent. I'm sorry, Wiccan Vixen. I always mess that up because I usually call you my Wonder Twin.
Are you trying to make me androgynous, Micah?
No, not at all. Nancy, I think you're as far from being androgynous as anyone I know. Of course, you are my Wonder Twin, so I should leave it at that. It is Valentine's Day. I don't want to get over amorous here on the airwaves with you. Over amorous on the airwaves with Micah Hanks. But Nancy, your program, the Vixen's Vault, is coming back to the airwaves this Thursday. I'm very thrilled to hear about this. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I started the Vault about a year ago. Basically, I had noticed a pretty large gap in the paranormal field when it came to radio shows. I think the intellect is represented, but it's not really represented by the feminine gender that well. I've been into the paranormal for over 20 years. I'm in all different fields of the paranormal and tend to research all different aspects and have a lot of contacts in the field, and I'm also a public extemporaneous speaker. So radio programming was kind of a natural instep for me. The show, while it was on the air, was incredibly popular, had a very large fan base. And again, we went topic to topic. We didn't just stick with ghost hunting. We were all over the fields with topics, including dream analogy. I mean, you name it, we hit it. There's really, as I like to say, there's no such thing as too far outside the box. If the topic's there, hit it. I mean, if it's a topic of interest, people want to talk about it, talk about it. But it was something where I had to go on sabbatical. I had a back injury that was kind of preventing me from actually being able to stay in a seated position for a long period of time. Made a few minor adjustments, you know, got everything up and rolling again, got myself connected, and bringing the show back on the air as of this Thursday, February 16th at 6 p.m. And Mr. Micah Hanks, as well as Mr. Scotty Roberts, are going to be my first interviews.
Oh, that's right. I'm going to be on your program, and I'm so thrilled, actually, Nancy. Any opportunity to be able to talk with you, I'm so glad. And, of course, my esteemed colleague and partner in crime, Scotty Roberts, will be joining me. That's going to be fantastic. You know, he's got his new book that just came out. He was on Coast to Coast AM the other night, and it was so funny because he was on from 3 to 5 a.m., and I literally woke up in the middle of the night, listened to his interview, and sent him a text message right afterward and said, Scotty, you did such a great job. That was one of the best interviews I've heard in quite some time. He calls me immediately right afterward, and we talk for another 30 minutes on the telephone. We had this incredible conversation. So, you know, Scotty and I are very close. I know you and Scotty are very close also, and I'm just so thrilled that bringing the Vixen's Vault back to the airwaves, Scotty and I can be your first guests and join you on the program.
I tell you, when I was thinking about it, you know, who I wanted to have on the program, one of the things I was kind of centered on was my comfort zone. And, you know, who do I really enjoy talking to? Who do I know is well-rounded? And the conversation, it flows, it's intelligent, but it gets kind of crazy. But in the same respect, it stays intelligent. I mean, and you and Scotty were, I mean, you know how I feel. I've known Scotty for 10 years. I've known you for several years. The connections there are pretty immediate. We all knew, we all thought alike from pretty much the get-go. And we're all from very different backgrounds, which is what makes it such an interesting triad of networking, really.
It's a trifecta of awesomeness. That's right. And, you know, and I tell you, I don't toss compliments around very lightly, but I do refer to you as my wonder twin. We have wonder twin powers, and when we unite, yes, very incredible things happen. So I'm very thrilled to be able to join you on this first renewed edition, the new and improved Vixen's Vault with Nancy Planetta, the Wiccan Vixen. Get it right that time, Mouth of the South. There we go. Not too bad. So anything else special going out on this new edition, this new and improved special first edition of the Vixen's Vault?
No, it's just, like I said, it's just, for me, it's just a day in the week. It's something I really enjoy doing. So it's, you know, I always think all of my shows are special because I try to put my personal touch into it, and I always tell people, it's me. My show is completely me. I was like, when you meet me in person, I am no different than what you hear on the airwaves. It's the way I think, it's the way I feel, it's the way I speak. I put that all into my show, and I pick my guests very carefully because, you know what, it's got to come off as something everybody's going to enjoy, not just us, because we know we can have a ball. You could lop you, me, and Scotty in a room, and we could go for probably centuries and never get bored.
That's right. That is true.
The idea is to keep, you know, keep our guests entertained, keep the listeners entertained, and maybe give them an education, maybe give them that extra outlet to go outside the box, to think for themselves, to think independently and not feel stupid about it.
Absolutely. Well, how can people tune in? Where can they tune in to listen?
Actually, what I'll be doing is, right now you can go to my webpage, www.thevixensvault.com. You can tune into the show directly from my webpage. We have hooked it up, so it's a direct link to the webpage. If you have a problem getting to that webpage, you can also, if you're on Facebook, you're going to be able to tune in through my Facebook. We will have a link up on that site. My Facebook is www.facebook.com/VixensVault, VixensVault.
Excellent. Well, it comes highly recommended. And, of course, if people don't get enough of their weekly Mouth of the South on this program, of course, they'll be able to hear me this Thursday night. And that's 6 p.m.
I'm further south than you, Micah.
Oh, goodness. Well, I tell you, again, it's 6 p.m., right? 6 p.m. Eastern.
Yes, sir. It'll be 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I'll tell you what, you know, can't wait to be able to share in the experience, you know, bringing you back to the airwaves. You know, we need a voice like yours, and it's fantastic that you're back in the saddle again. You know, I don't know why it is, Nancy, that so many talk radio hosts tend to get back injuries. I know Art Bell went through that all, so fortunately I'm not suffering any, you know, chronic back fatigue right now, and I hope that yours has improved so that you can get behind the seat and, you know, take the airwaves more regularly, because again, it is a fantastic program, and I'm sure listeners of this program will enjoy it just as well.
Well, you know what? Like I said, it's not even the injury at this point. I'm just learning to work around it. It is unfortunately a permanent injury, but you know, it's something that I'm working around. I miss being on the air. It was, you know, that it was an integral part of my life. Mm-hmm. It was something I was doing 5 days a week, and absolutely loved it. I had a great time every time I was on the air. So I figured, you know what? Can't sit here and feel sorry for yourself. You got to figure a way around it. This is what you love. You're going to figure out a way to do it.
That's right.
And I have.
even if you have to lay down while you're on the air, then you just sound very relaxed. You know, the Vixen's Vault with Nancy Planetta.
When I was working this with the new network, that was one of my first questions. Oh, God, please don't tell me it's video cam. Because, let me tell you, sweatpants, white beater, way to go when you're on the air.
Oh, you're just putting it all out there, I'd say. But that's what we like about you. In fact, that's what I love about you, Nancy. So from me to you, much love on Valentine's Day. Looking forward to talking to you Thursday. And you have a wonderful rest of the evening. We'll look forward to airtime this week, okay?
All righty, Mikey. I will talk to you later and have a great evening. Thanks for having me on.
Anytime, my friend, anytime. And with that, that is Nancy Planetta. Again, you can tune into the program this week. It's going to be 6 p.m. Eastern time. We'll put a link to the Vixen's Vault page in the show notes for this week's program so that people can find that. Certainly not something that you're going to want to miss. Nancy is truly a talent, and she's one of the very best. She brings a feminine voice to this field, and it's not just the voice of the females, the Wiccans, or anybody like that. You know what? She is also a voice of reason. She's one of the most intelligent people I know. Proud to call her a wonder twin. That's Nancy Planetta. Her program will air again this week. And with that, we'll be back right after this break with more weird news, anomalistics, and exopolitics from beyond the fringe. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks.
Some fun? Maybe get a little bit of insight. Get a lay of the land. Want to know what's really going on? Do what I do. Listen to Future Theater. It airs every Saturday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, on the Inception Radio Network.com. We'll see you there.
Of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grayling Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Welcome back to the program. Matt Oakley to the rescue here, our engineer extraordinaire. Get your hands out of the air, back on the board there, brother, because we're going to require you to pot down that music there. The sounds of Mr. Mac Maloney, whose book, UFOs in Wartime, was featured on an earlier edition of this program. He's also a musician, and he was kind enough to provide us with some tunes, which we do feature from time to time as comeback music on this program. But that said, you know, Mac is best known as a science fiction writer. He writes about space stuff. And there was some talk a while back about, literally, I've actually got a link to the story pulled up on my BlackBerry because of some sort of technical difficulty that we had here in the studio a minute ago, about NASA considering a deep space outpost. You know, the thing is that I think that the title of that post says it all, but really our producer is far more versed in this story. I think, Chris, you could probably describe the essence of that story better than I could read it off of my BlackBerry here in the studio, and I'm sure that you wouldn't mind doing that for us real quick right now.
Well, basically, NASA wants to build a deep space outpost on the moon.
That's really all there is to it, huh? But
but it's not going to happen because they don't have any money.
Right. NASA is concerning the possibility of a deep space moon outpost. This is according to space.com earlier this week. However, apparently, and actually, I'm literally trying to load this on my BlackBerry, and it's moving around, so I couldn't read the rest of that sentence. NASA's fiscal year 2013 budget cuts may axe the space agency's plans before any astronauts could ever reach the launch pad. So, you know, again, this is kind of one of those circumstances where American space exploration is being stunted somewhat by our inability to fund continued efforts to reach the outer cosmos and the like.
Yeah, it's not cheap, though, apparently. I'm going over this story now, and it says NASA requested $17.7 billion for 2013, which is when they plan to, I guess, initiate this idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it says the space agency's budget request represents a 5% reduction from the $18.7 billion that President Barack Obama set aside for NASA in a budget he sent to Congress in February 2011. And NASA budget cuts would severely impact the Space Agency's Planetary Science Division. The Space Agency's latest budget proposal would decrease funding for this division from $1.5 billion to $1.2 billion.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, that said, we were talking with one of our financial advisors before the program earlier this evening, and he was advising, he was talking about some of the budgetary, concerns right now. As a matter of fact, actually, you know, he's a person, I can't mention him by name right now, because this individual, he works for a banking institution and an investment management firm. Where he is really, he's kind of limited in terms of how many media appearances he can make and talk about these kinds of things. But when I was talking with him, we'll call him Commander X for the time being, and he was laying it all out on the table just a few hours before airtime with the three of us. You know, Matt and Chris and I are standing there talking. My jaws literally, you know, dropped, and we're talking about, for instance, I think what he was talking about specifically, what was it? Was it the new budget proposal that President Obama's put forth, and even the Democrats are saying that we're not going to vote for this?
Like everybody in the Senate's saying, apparently, that there's no reason to even send it to them because nobody's going to vote for this.
Yeah, and it's, if I understand correctly, in excess of $1 trillion at this point.
Yeah, it was, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was over that, I believe.
How are you supposed to regulate the machine without money, Micah?
Well, that's just the thing is that, you know, we've got candidates like Ron Paul right now who are saying that, you know, his first term in office, he would cut spending by $1 trillion. Our current commander-in-chief, on the other hand, is trying to propose, you know, apparently $1 trillion plus in deficit spending. And then we've got, you know, the space program. And again, the thing is that, you know, they're talking about, you know, cutting back to what, $1 billion? The question is, you know, and I'm not trying to complain or say that we need favoritism in one area or another, but how important is space exploration? I think, personally, we do need to take care of the problems here on Terra Firma first.
Definitely.
These are things that have to be addressed here on the home front. That said, at some point, we also need to be able to further our, you know, understanding of space and the cosmos. And, you know, every now and then I do begin to look at the numbers, you know, the cash flow. And I start to think, you know, what is really going on here? You know, what? There's something else that our financial advisor was talking about was, you know, this essentially 15% on home sales, okay, that would go to the United States Treasury, 15% tax, okay, on the sale of homes.
It was actually 3.8%, but the the example he was using totaled $15,000.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I got my numbers wrong. Yeah. Okay, so but that was something that was included in the Obamacare bill. What about healthcare involves, again, percentages in tax that go that are levied on the sale of homes and property?
And really, anybody, if they're honest with themselves, would say nothing. But
you're right.
But you know, there's definitely the argument that a lot of people will make. Well, that's how we fund it.
That's how we
fund healthcare. Well, free health care for all, Micah.
Well, but
come
it's not free for free health care, though.
I mean, well, see, I mean, it'd kind of be free for me because I don't own a house.
So. Yeah, well.
Well, depending on how you look at it, I
but,
guess.
And really, I mean, why are you whining about having to pay your 3.8%? Because
well,
when
I'm not
you sell
house,
your house,
yeah.
when you sell your house, you get money, and that's income.
Wait, I don't get money. I pay extra
and you don't
money.
Deserve you all get, that income.
You're getting money, and it's income.
Oh, in other words, oh, okay, if I
so
sell
I
my house.
So the money basically you're getting from your house has been taxed so many times that it's just insult to injury at this point.
But yeah. I think, in other words, and this is something else we were talking about before the show, Matt, you know, it's like how much more of this kind of thing are people going to take and just stand for it? You know, well, okay, I'm just lucky to be able to sell my house in these economically woeful times, so a 3.8% tax or whatever, you know, is something that should be negligible. To hell with it. Don't worry about it, right? Just take it. You're lucky to be able to make the quote-unquote income, you know, off of the sale. And I don't
you're
consider
you're
that...
lucky we allow you to make
at
the
least
income,
you have
right?
a house, all right?
Right. I know. Well, you know, I tell you, so many of us are lucky to be able to even be able to say that right now. So again, you know, I got way off subject. The point is that considering all these kinds of things, considering these kind of issues, we are in economically woeful times. At what point does our furtherance of our knowledge of space and the cosmos become a precedent, become important again, and when can we put funding into that? Or will there be at this point, if things keep going this in this direction, will there be a point where we can look at those kind of things seriously again and be able to put together a reasonable budget for that and justify doing so?
And I would agree with you about 99%, but just to play...
Oh, so you're the 99% now, huh?
Yeah. No, just to play devil's advocate here for a minute, I mean,
communist.
Definitely, oh, man.
Let him talk!
You
let
call
the
me
man.
A commie one more time.
Cut his mic off, man, just let him...
You're done.
Chris, let him talk.
No, really, to play devil's advocate, if you think about it, how much, you know, if we're going into the unexplained and everything, how much unexplained stuff is there on terra firma that we're still yet to find out about?
Mm-hmm.
There's so many, you know, the depths of our oceans are still unexplored, you know, a large percent of it. And we're still worried about going off into space.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know, let's deal with all aspects of Fortiana here as well.
Well, that's a good thing, I think, to do indeed. So that said, will we get off the ground again? Will we be able to work the space program back into the general, you know, future outlook for Earth and for humanity? I don't know. You know, I don't have the answer to that kind of a question. Who knows? But maybe with luck, we will manage to work that out. We'll see what happens. So, anyway, moving right along, though, we had a couple other things. You know, what was this other story that we had here that we were looking at? One of them was this not anti-gravity, it was a cloaking technology that we were looking at there. Matt, actually, you know, before we get to that, let's take this in another direction. Since we were talking about space and the cosmos, actually, I want to get over to this nuclear blast on Mars thing first. And we might go to the phones here in a minute. I think we did have a caller trying to get in just a second ago. But that said, we were talking about a moon, you know, a lunar base. Whether we will ever get off the ground to where we can literally be involved to some serious extent with lunar exploration again in the future. And I did an article for Mysterious Universe this week that was very interesting. I mentioned we're going to have Joseph P. Farrell, who is a alternative history researcher. He's going to be on the program with us soon. And something very interesting that I found over at his blog was a story that dealt with... he actually had linked a story, I think, that had initially appeared maybe on Fox News. And it dealt with the idea that there could have been, at some point, some kind of nuclear explosion on Mars. And this is just such a strange idea because, again... this is supposed to be something that might have happened. And again, you know, ideally, in order to really be able to lay the groundwork and discern what could have been potentially going on in that regard, especially on, you know, another planet. I mean, you know, even something as I put air quotes here, as close as Mars, we would conceivably have to be able to go there or be able to involve ourselves in some sort of a remote observation system that's a little more advanced than what we're doing right now. But there's apparently some evidence, specifically according to Dr. John Brandenburg with Orbital Technologies Corp., that has to do with the potential for what some have called a massive nuclear explosion that occurred in at some point on Mars. It curiously was described as seeming to defy natural explanation. I wrote for MysteriousUniverse.com earlier this week that while circumstances could have allowed such a thing to occur in a natural way, I mean, supernova, you know, and you know, mass coronal ejections and things like that could constitute a large-scale, even explosive event on a planet. Again, those kinds of things are unlikely at best. Not impossible, but unlikely at best. And so there's this, apparently, this faction of researchers who have discussed the potential for there having been, at some point in the past, a nuclear event that occurred on Mars. Now, when I was writing for this Lost Civilizations and Secrets of the Past anthology that New Page Books put out late last year, I wrote about evidence of ancient nuclear events, and I'm very careful to make the distinction between nuclear explosions and nuclear events myself. And the reason for that is, of course, because it's very difficult to say with certainty that there could have been the kind of advanced technology in ancient times that could have been conducive to an explosion, a nuclear explosion involving atomic weaponry in ancient times. But there seems to be evidence of something like that that occurred here on Earth. And there are also researchers who say, like this Dr. John Brandenburg with Orbital Technologies Corporation, who also describe the potential for such a thing having occurred on the Red Planet long, long ago. Which brings us to Joseph P. Farrell and his new book, which is called Saucers, Swastikas, and PSYOPs, A History of a Breakaway Civilization. We're going to talk with Joseph Farrell very soon, and I'm interested in this guy and his research specifically because he, again, follows these kinds of stories. His whole premise is that there, indeed, when we're talking about where does money go, when we're talking about where does, you know, when we can't even fund a space program to try and understand what the hell might have gone on in ancient times on a planet like Mars, let alone nuclear events that occurred in ancient times here on Earth, we can't even fund a space program, an exploration that can seek to understand these kind of ancient mysteries, and yet there may be something going on in our midst that involves the flow of money and little operations and things that are going on behind the scenes. I mean, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to see that these kind of things go on all the time. You know, and if we could sit there and read the thousands of pages that go, you know, into these spending bills that even the congressmen and the congresswomen and the senators and the like that vote on these things every day, you know, they don't have time to read all this stuff. You know, their staff don't have time to read the thousands of pages that go into all these bills. And we've got people like Nancy Pelosi in office talking about how we'll pass the legislation and then we'll find out what's in it after it's passed. Let's vote on it. Let's pass it now, and then we'll read and find out what's in it later. These little kind of loopholes and exclusions, these little underdealings and things, those happen every day. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to think that there are things that are gone, you know, that are going on, and that they're dusted under the rug and out of sight, not only of those people who are voting on these things, but especially the American public, the people who are going to be affected by this the very most. And so when I look at someone like Joseph Farrell, we're looking at the cutting of budget, you know, budgetary, you know, funding and the like for NASA. And we're looking at how we're having to all kind of, you know, scrimp and save and try and pull together loose ends. Things are looking so bad right now. And yet there is still some sort of obvious price fixing going on, money being funneled back to this organization or that. Deficit spending continues. There are all these issues. If somebody wants money, they can sure as hell get it if they need it. Farrell addresses this in some of his books, and the potential that indeed that there could be an element, you know, we might even call it, you know, I'm going to get into Alex Jones territory here for a second, but a globalist agenda to operate and orchestrate pricing in such a way that is conducive to funding maybe some sort of a cabal, you know. And when And when, the guys are threatening.
We need the Alex Jones scream.
Well, I don't know that we do. I think we need a sound bite where we can have. We can do without that. We don't want to override, blow up the board if we do that.
You do it. It hurts.
Yeah. But anyway, I have this quote from Joseph Farrell that was posted at his website. And I just want to share this with regard to his own observations of some sort of an event that took place on Mars. And he's not saying that we sent a nuclear weapon into space and blew up something on Mars. That's not what he's saying. But he does say the following, and this is pretty interesting and revelatory, especially when we're thinking outside the box in terms of what could have happened on nearby planets. What do we really know about our own role in all this as people? What do we even know about these sorts of things, the potential for their occurrence in ancient times here on Earth? And I'm talking about nuclear events. And he writes, make no mistake, there is evidence here on Earth that natural nuclear reactors formed and operated for a period of time long ago, but these are fission reactors, and fission processes would be, to my mind, next to impossible to generate this amount of energy naturally. And fusion processes of this magnitude occurring naturally on a planet, well, that too does not, to my mind, compute very easily. Now, if Brandenburg is correct that all this evidence is of a gigantic thermonuclear explosion on the red planet eons ago, then my bet is that it was the product both of technology and deliberate action. In short, it was the occurrence of an act of war. That's one hell of a statement to make. But let me tell you, if you're not familiar with Joseph P. Farrell and his research, let me tell you what his background is. Okay, not only is he an alternative history historian and someone who focuses specifically on World War II and the Nazis, okay, but he also holds a PhD and he's an author. This guy is an absolute workaholic. He probably puts out two or three books a year that deal with subjects ranging from the esoteric to physics to fringe science to history. And then he also addresses these notions of what he calls a history of a breakaway civilization. In other words, the potential that there could be organizations and activities going on behind the scenes, okay, that probably and inevitably would have to draw their funding from somewhere, okay, to bring this conversation around full circle to some degree. That money, I mean, you don't do this kind of stuff. You don't fund activities and operations that literally would allow for elements of our society. Well, actually, I would have to say things existing outside of society, but elements maybe of our civilization that exists and operate outside of what we all understand in everyday society here on planet Earth. Advanced technology, monetary, transactions and fixing and funding and the like. This is what he calls a breakaway civilization. And he deals with this in this new book that I'm going to talk with him about here in just a few weeks. And he says, again, that this could somehow have something to do with a lot of the kinds of stuff that we realize and that we observe and that we even take for granted in our daily lives. And he writes about this. I just think it's really fascinating. And so someone with that kind of perspective of history, and if you want a good example of Farrell and his research, I think back in, it was a few years ago. I'm not sure exactly what the year was. It may have been 2009, but he was a speaker at the International UFO Congress. And there's a two-segment interview with him. Each segment is a little longer than an hour. So it's a long, it's not an interview. I'm sorry. It's a speech that he gave. It's a little long, but he talks very little about UFOs. He talks mostly about the Nazis and what kind of technology they may have had available to the, toward the end of the Second World War. There's even evidence of the Nazis having detonated a nuclear bomb and that they had actually harnessed the power of the atom. It gets really wild, but he presents incredibly good evidence to back these claims up, unlike a lot of researchers out there. And he still is criticized. And no matter who it is or what is being said, I take all of it with a grain of salt. I'm very careful not to commit belief to anything. But I'll tell you, of a lot of the researchers that I've looked at, Farrell really supports his with evidence, affidavits, historical documentation, video and photo evidence in his lectures and presentations. I mean, he really is able to back up historically, academic training to do so as a historian and as a writer and as a researcher. And so when I hear him say things like, if Brandenburg is correct that all this evidence is of a gigantic thermonuclear explosion on Mars long, long time ago, then my bet is that it was the product of both technology and deliberate action, and in short, it was also the occurrence of an act of war. That can't be taken as gospel, But I'm very interested in that statement coming from a guy like Farrell. Can't wait to talk with him. He's a very interesting individual, and you know, I'd love to pick his brain about some of those sorts of things. And here in a few weeks, hopefully, we'll do that. So that said, we'll leave that one be for the time being. We'll link the article, though. Was there an ancient nuclear event of some sort on Mars in ancient times? That'll be in the show notes for this week's edition of the program. When we come back, we'll wrap things up here on the Grayley Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be back right after this.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project, we never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Learn more about what we do at WoundedWarriorProject.org.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
This...
Appalachia. It's the Grayling Report with Micah Hanks. To join the program by phone, call 828-398-4886. Skype users can reach the program by calling Skype ID Grayling Report. And now, from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma, in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grayling Bunker, it's Micah Hanks.
Wrapping things up with you this Tuesday evening, Valentine's Day. We're angering all the paradames by doing a live broadcast on, the holiday of love. The holiday of sensitivity and connecting with those who mean the most to us in our lives. You know, we were talking during the last segment about, again, this far-out idea. And again, I don't think it's too far out at all to suppose. In fact, there is scientific evidence of a nuclear event on Mars. It's just the opinions of some that maybe there was something more to that than just a supernova or the conventional and yet very difficult to substantiate claims. You know, again, we can see evidence of something. We can't substantiate ideas as to what may have caused a nuclear event of that sort. Really strange stuff. And while we're talking about strange anomalies that occurred long, long ago, you know, a few listeners this week have emailed me since we talked about Lake Vostok on the program last week. We were discussing how on the program there were interesting connections between the Russian operation to drill down into this lake, you know, in Antarctica. And EnterpriseMission.com. Many people who listen to this program are going to be very well familiar with this site. But there's an article there that talks a bit about Lake Vostok and something that has been brought to my attention recently that I was actually unaware of. And the fact that there is, get this, apparently some sort of a strange magnetic anomaly that is associated with Lake Vostok. You know, some sources have even described this as being similar to if you were in an airplane using magnetic detection equipment and you flew over a large major metropolitan area. They say it's the same sort of interaction that you would expect from a city that appears to emanate from around or maybe beneath Lake Vostok. A team of scientists from Columbia University working under the auspices of the NSF early in 2001 began a series of unprecedented low-altitude aerial surveys over the lake, according to EnterpriseMission.com, designed to chart gravitational, magnetic, and thermal activity under the ice. In the course of doing so, they made a stunning find. According to sources, it was a huge magnetic anomaly that was discovered there, covering the entire southeast portion of the shore of the lake. This remarkable anomaly, which is discrepant from the background by over 1,000 nanoteslas, that's a significant variance compared to a daily variation that can be observed in Earth's own magnetic field. This, of course, could be caused by some sort of natural process. Okay, let me amend that statement. The discrepancy is very different from that which could be caused by natural processes. Now, one possibility voiced by Columbia's Michael Studinger is that the Earth's crust is in the vicinity of the lake, is actually, the Earth's crust that is in this vicinity of the lake is simply thinner under this section of Antarctica, having been stretched during the formation of the lake bed itself. Now, this, according to Studinger, would result in what he called a local magnetic anomaly, but others, like the Enterprise consulting geologist Ron Nix, have said that they have serious difficulty with this theory. Nix explains that such a thinning would actually heat the underlying rock and thus diminish rather than increase the crust's ability to locally amplify the Earth's own magnetic field. Now, there is, as always, an equally viable alternative explanation here. An anomaly like this could also be caused by an accumulation of metals, the kind that you would get if you found the ruins of perhaps, yes, an ancient buried city. And that's exactly what some people think is actually under the ice down there at Lake Vostok, which is so interesting because on the program last week, what were we talking about? We'd gotten an email from a listener, and what were we talking about?
H.P. Lovecraft.
That's right. Who had described his own take on strange things under the South Pole. An ancient city under the ice. Such a discovery would be absolutely dazzling, sending shock waves through our world as profound as the discovery of artifacts on Mars. Maybe even evidence of a nuclear blast on Mars. And the notion is not as improbable as some may think. In fact, there's a growing trend toward the acceptance of the notion of catastrophism as a viable alternative to conventional geological models. Did you even know that that word existed, fellas? Catastrophism. This is in opposition to the current but retreating geological model called gradualism, the concept that geologic changes only happen slowly and over several passing eons. However, more and more evidence has mounted from the Vostok ice cores, for example, that climatological changes can happen rapidly. Some attribute these catastrophic changes in the record to sudden polar shifts, and many researchers from a variety of different fields and different approaches to the evidence have put the last such sudden shift at around 13,000 years ago. It's not just a heartbeat. Now, under this catastrophic model, Antarctica might well have been a temperate or even a jungle continent at some point, maybe as recently as that 13,000 years back time frame. A sudden change in the Earth's alignment relative to the sun would have plunged this once hospitable land into a perpetual freezing hell, as cold as Mars and in some places maybe colder. Indeed, it is easy to see Antarctica as maybe Adolf Hitler did, as the source of worldwide Atlantis legends that we've all heard about and read about over the years. According to at least one source, Dr. Wernher von Braun of NASA, you know, a former Nazi scientist, he was convinced that Hitler's belief in an Atlantis below the ice may have actually been correct. So it's interesting that indeed there are all these rumors and all this speculation about what might exist under the ice down there at the South Pole. And if we want to go ahead and tie Nazis into all this, what did everyone fear that the Nazis had planned to do down there at the South Pole all along? Indeed, they had hoped to build some sort of a base. Do you guys know why the Nazis had interest in building a base at Antarctica, by the way? What about Antarctica would be so important in terms of having a military base there?
Penguins?
It's cold.
Yeah, both of those things are obviously of military importance. Snow's the good one right there.
They could build a massive army of snowmen.
Snowmen?
Yeah.
Close.
And just, like, dress them in uniforms.
You know, here's the thing. If you think about it in terms of, you know, a strategic outpost, okay, from Antarctica, if you can weather the cold, literally you could fly in any direction and you would be approximately equidistant from any of the major continents, you know, whether it be North America or Europe or Asia. And so, of course, in terms of strategy, or at very least strategic disposition, maybe Antarctica had obvious potential. The problem is, of course, is the practicality often was not there in terms of the temperatures and the accessibility, and, of course, the ability to harness power systems and things like that. But, obviously, the Nazis weren't the only ones who became interested in this, and they're the fabled. They're literally, at this point, at this stage in the game, the fabled expeditions, you know, Operation High Jump and, you know, Admiral Byrd's adventures, for lack of a better term. It probably is a better term, but I would like to call them adventures because, again, there is this kind of mythology that's been built around Admiral Byrd and his explorations of Antarctica for very similar purposes, you know, for use in the potential, you know, outfitting for military purposes and for providing some kind of a structure, you know, that A, would keep the enemies from being able to utilize that area for the same purposes. In other words, the first man to the, you know, to the field gets to play ball. And that, thus, that would allow them to corner an area that, indeed, in terms of military strategy, would grant them potentially one hell of an advantage. But that said, again, I think that the negatives far outweighed the potentials in terms of their hope for what anyone might do with Antarctica, and thus it takes away pretty greatly from the idea that there was something else going on down there. But that doesn't. That alone won't, you know, that's not enough to deter the proponents of the ideas that the Nazis actually build bases down there. And for all we know, maybe Hitler and some of these guys actually escaped to the South Pole and they went on living there. And that's where the UFOs, the Nazi UFOs, are still parked to this very day. Who knows what's going on down there, really? That'll have to do it for this week. On behalf of Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Holly, producer Chris Hayes, engineer Matt Oakley, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, we bid you adieu, my friends. Until next week, stay strange.